It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Stacey has the week off. Glenn Fleischman is here. He'll give us some Jeopardy tips from his appearance there. Aunt Pruitt, Jeff Jarvis, Elon Musk, and others say, let's pause AI research until we're sure this is safe. Is that the right thing to do? The Internet Archive loses its fight, but should they have lost? We'll also talk about TikTok and a Norwegian ammo company that says, we can't make bullets because TikTok is right next door. All that and a lot more coming up next on Twig.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twig. This Week in Google, episode 709, recorded Wednesday, March 29th, 2023. The Egg from Hell. This Week in Google is brought to you by HPE GreenLake, orchestrated by the experts at CDW, who can help you consolidate and manage all your data in one flexible edge-to-cloud platform to scale and innovate. Learn more at cdw.com/HPE. Thanks for listening to this show. As an ad-supported network, we are always looking for new partners with products and services that will benefit our qualified audience. Are you ready to grow your business? Reach out to advertise@twit.tv and launch your campaign now. It's time for Twig This Week in Google, the show where we get together with some people that I like and talk about stuff that really has nothing to do with Google. So really false advertising all around. Aunt Pruitt is here from Hands On Photography. Hello, Aunt.
Hello, Mr. Laporte. How you be, sir?
Did you enjoy Richard Campbell's description of distillation on Windows Weekly?
Unfortunately, I couldn't watch the live stream because I was stuffing my face with the awesome Twit-provided lunch.
Oh, so. Well. Then, yes, so, given the choice between lunch and any of our shows, I would choose lunch. I don't blame you.
But I will be going back and checking out the real.
Yeah, it was good. We were talking about still.
He's so knowledgeable.
Yeah, it's now been like a 3 or 4 part series on how whiskey's made. It's really fascinating. Also with us, the Leonard Tao Professor for Journalistic Innovation at the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism at the City University of New York. Hello, Jeff.
Hello.
BuzzMachine.com. Did you get a new camera, a new hairdo? What's going on?
I don't know. Is it ridiculous?
It's gorgeous.
It's not. You look
It looks
great,
like George
sir.
Washington.
I don't know what to do. I've got more than you want to know about me. I got cowlicks all over. So this was just puffing up on its own.
If you could get a powdered wig that looked like that, I would wear it. It's fabulous.
Hey, I think I'm going to take that as mockery.
No, it looks good. It looks really good. No, and you're not too pink. Which is why I'm asking about the camera. I mean, it just really looks...
Oh, the camera. No. It's the luck of the moment when I come on. That's all. It'll screw up.
It's the glow.
It's lighter here now, so the light will change.
Yeah, the glow of the light from Bedminster. Just glowing on you. Also
the
here...
The light from the west, yes.
Stacey has the week off, but good news. Glenn Fleischman has agreed, has consented to fill in.
Hello.
Nice to see you. Welcome.
Ahoy, ahoy. Nice to see everybody.
Ahoy, ahoy, Glenn.
Glenn, this is the success of his Kickstarter.
Oh, that's right. So how much did you raise for Shift Happens?
$753,000 and some change.
That would be three-quarters of $1 million.
Amazing. Mm. Amazing.
Pretty wild.
And that
Pretty
book...
Wild. People like keyboards.
Which you helped kind of foster, written by Marcin... that's not the book. This
Wickery.
Is the book. Wickery. Gotta say it carefully. Shift Happens. Is all about keyboards. There's something about keyboards and keyboard nerds. It's just kind of amazing. So congratulations.
Like it. Thank you. It's very, very exciting.
What do you do with the extra money? Is that like a payday for Marcin or...
Well, you know, mattresses feel really good when they're stuffed with $1 bills.
Yes.
As the banking system has shown, is the best place to put your money now. Well, No, we make things get better. So that's the Kickstarter thing, is it's really hard to change your pricing and tiers. Like at one point we're like, could we reduce the shipping? Although shipping is kind of inflexible. So instead we had stretch goals. So instead of originally it was like, well, we'll add a third volume with some extras. Now the third volume is going to be 160 pages and full color. So the whole thing is actually 1,376 pages divided across.
Holy cow.
We're denuding entire forests.
Yeah, there's a lot of trees are dying for this.
Yeah. Had some very long and complicated conversations with the printers in Maine. Fortunately, there are a lot of trees near Maine that can just go chop a few more down in order to reduce the paper.
You've also put some energy into games on the Shift Happens website. There's some really fun stuff.
Yeah, Marching made this great one, which is a typewriter, like a manual typewriter simulator, which is shifthappens.site/typewriter. And if you go there, you can type, and it has like a piece of paper you can move around. And it actually has, if you type too fast, it overtypes. And, it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun.
There's a whole generation that has no idea what a typewriter is.
You ask somebody a dial phone. I'll tell you, one of the funniest things that I did a few months ago is YouTube brought up this, you remember those old self-help, or not self-help videos, but they were like sometimes multi-hour VHSs you'd get that would be how to use the Commodore 64 or something like that. And this shows up, a digitized version, our YouTube feed, and my 15-year-old is like, oh, let's watch that. And everything is amazing to them. They're like, wait, you could choose from 16 colors? Like, yes, we had as many as 16 colors. Where the guy goes to pull the 5 1/4-inch disc out, and my Alex is like, what is that? I'm like, oh, well, that was the smaller disc. I used to work with 8-inch discs. They said, oh, did 8-inch discs hold more storage? I said, no, of course not. They held less. So it's kind of fun to expose the kids to it because they're weirdly, everything is big and floppy and strange, and they can't even envision, like, wait, you worked with this? Like, yeah, so it's always, typewriters are much more approachable, right? You sit down, you start tapping away at it. It's great. I went to, we now have 3 typewriter stores in Washington State within about an hour of each other. I went to one that just opened. So apparently we're in a typewriter store boom.
Oh, you would be, yes. So I don't think we're ready to announce anything yet, but there's a chance that Glenn and I and Marson and Doug Wilson will be together in Massachusetts for an event.
That's right.
Yes, very exciting.
Right after July 4th, if
at
it all
the
works
Museum
out.
Of printing.
At the incredible Austin Riggs Center for the Perpetually Depressed. It's going to be, it'll be so much fun. So much fun. That's great. Congratulations. That's really wonderful.
Thank you.
It's nice to see good things happen to nice people, since they so often happen to awful people.
Exactly. Exactly. Well said.
So our top story tonight, is Elon Musk and others calling for a pause, a 6-month pause on AI, citing profound risks to society.
So Elon can catch up.
Yeah, maybe that's, first of all, anything Elon thinks is a good idea is a bad idea to me. But a lot of other co-signers, including Steven Wozniak, the founder of Apple, the presidential candidate and universal basic income supporter,
and
Andrew
General
Yang.
Blatherer of idiocy.
General Blatherer. Rachel Bronson, who is the president of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. Gary Marcus, an entrepreneur and academic.
Listen, that atomic clock, that doomsday clock has never hit 12 yet. Clearly,
you know, I interviewed George Church a couple of weeks ago on triangulation. He's a father of modern genomics, but also new member of the board of the atomic clock folks, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. And I asked him, he said, yeah, I noticed it never hit. He said, I don't know how long it's going to last on the board. He said, yeah, it seems to be that if they can get it as close as possible to noon, that's always a good thing. You get more press that way. And in fact, the most recent story about the atomic clock, the idea of the doomsday clock is if it ever hits noon, it's over for the planet. And the closer we get to the noon, the closer we are to Armageddon. Is it midnight? It's midnight, not noon. Noon is the bright sun above our heads. It's midnight. You're right, of course. Noon, whatever, midnight. 12 o'clock. But the most recent story was, it's closer than it's ever been before. Really? Closer than the Cuban Missile Crisis? Really? Anyway, it is maybe perhaps atomic link bait. I don't know.
I might have quoted this on the show before, but one of the best things that the guy who did fake Steve Jobs said was, I always quote this, is when Google announced the Open Handset Alliance, he said something like, losers join alliances. And there's something about, if you're winning, you don't need an alliance, you just have your product. So something about Elon Musk and a bunch of people saying, whoa, this is going too fast because we're not ready for it yet. It does feel a little
soft. Well, as many people have pointed out, of course, great idea. We should stop OpenAI while China just goes right on ahead catching up. Right. I mean, there's so many obvious, this is just such obviously non-starter of an idea.
And the thing that I've seen a lot of is that it's more of tech boy ego.
Yeah, I think that's is, what it is.
We're so powerful. We're so dangerous. Stop us before we kill. Oh, we could do terrible things, right? It's BS.
That's what somebody said on Mastodon is the letter reads as basically PR hype for the power of AI.
Exactly. Like,
wow, yeah. We're really getting close to AGI. We should stop. Whereas I think most intelligent people say we are not close to artificial general intelligence.
No. The language in it is just ridiculous.
And, you know, if you don't connect ChatGPT-4 to anything that has agency in the world, it's probably pretty harmless. It's not exactly, you know, going to set off the nuclear weapons or anything. It can't, right?
Should we let machines flood our information channels with propaganda and untruth? Should we automate all the jobs, including the fulfilling ones? Should we develop non-human minds that might eventually outnumber, outsmart, obsolete, and replace us? Huh? Should we? Should we?
You know, the motorized clothes
ringer.
You
lost
ringer.
Your chance. Come on. There you go.
I was waiting on you to pause.
Okay. I would never wait for me to breathe. It doesn't happen.
The crank-driven clothes ringer really, I think, made a lot of housewives unhappy because it took away one of their primary pleasures during the day.
We should have put a six-month pause on that hand ringer. Yeah. Damn it. Just really had a let's form a committee to analyze the impact of the hand ringer on the women of America.
It seems to be so much panic about the chat-based AI stuff, but we're already seeing incredible limitations. We don't know. I've said this before, but I feel like there's this idea that all technology reaches an apotheosis, but AI has limitations. We don't know how close they get. Like, can chat-based can a generalized chat-based AI that can answer kind of any question? Can it actually be trained to not hallucinate? We don't know the answer to that. Nobody in computer science or in businesses knows the answer. Hallucination, like invention of things, may just be an inherent risk in the algorithm. There's no way to do that without clamping down and making it domain expertise specific, which could be very useful, but doesn't provoke the same kind of scare.
The other thing, Glenn, I think you're right. I think the answer to that is no. In its present form, large language models, Emily Bender talks about this all the time, cannot do that. B, you're right. If they were domain specific, then perhaps. But what gets me most at right now is that in their present form, it is wildly irresponsible for Microsoft and Google to talk about their use in search, one. And two, it is wildly irresponsible for media to turn around and, I caught it in an error. It's going to destroy mankind. And then have an impact on where we are. And I got a discussion about this with somebody on Mastodon today. Well, shouldn't we stop? Shouldn't we stop? There's a great essay by James Doerr from the Rand, whatever it is, Rand Corporation, in the 90s. It said, we've got to get to the unintended consequences faster so we get to the experience, so we learn what the impact are, so we can then do something. If we stop it, we can't learn anything. Then we're just stopping the clock for 6 months, and then we'll come back in 6 months and say, do we know anything more? No, we can't because we didn't use it.
So before you use ChatGPT to cheat on Wordle, by the way, so John, you must have had a Wordle game where you had the second letter you knew was U, the fifth letter is O. So John asked ChatGPT, do you know any five-letter words where the second letter is U and the fifth letter is O? It suggested flute.
What?
Lout.
Brute, fruit, grunt, truce, sprue, crude, prune, sprug, and glute. None of which have O in the fifth letter.
It doesn't understand anything.
And none of which have U in the second letter. It was just wrong. So then you gave it a little nudge in the answers you gave. John says the second letter is not you. I apologize for the error in my previous response. Here are some five-letter words where the second letter is U and the fifth letter is O. Bound, clout, flout. No, no. It can't even play Wordle.
No, I asked it to, there's a new product called Wavelength. It's like an integrated chat based thing with it's a human based group chat system.
Yes, this is John Gruber's ridiculous. Okay, right. Go ahead.
But I just tried the chat. It has integrated chat GPT in it. And I'm like, oh,
because everything's better with an AI in it, right?
So I said, I figure this is a straightforward one. I said, explain Einstein's theory of relativity as a very short poem in AABB or ABAB format. Yeah. And it gives me AABB. And I said, no, you're wrong. That's AABB. This is, oh, I'm sorry. You're right. And it gives me AABB again. It's like, no, that's still, do you know how to do this? And it gives me AAAA. And I'm like, you're still, I said, maybe you shouldn't be writing poetry, ChatGPT. You know,
go but home, ChatGPT.
Honestly, ChatGPT-4 probably would do that better. I don't know what chat they put into Wavelength. Wavelength's an interesting story. So you got suckered in too. John Gruber on his Daring Fireball publishes like a 4,000 word article. About halfway through, he says, oh, by the way, I'm an advisor to it, and they gave me some stock. That's why. So you should have put it front, you know, hashtag ad, hashtag sponsor. I think John thought because it wasn't a lot of stock that, it's okay. But all it is it's good. It's end-to-end encrypted group chat. It's like end-to-end encrypted group chat, not from Facebook is its selling point. Plus AI. I forgot. Plus AI.
listen, I'll tell you.
One buzzword in it.
If John pours me a drink, I'm going to drink it. So that's the.
Yeah. You know, that's what a lot of people did.
In fact,
that's who's in here is all of the, all Jason Snell, Merlin Mann, Glenn Fleischman. It's all the Apple Mafia. So
we're all in there. Yeah. It's interesting. I like that people are experimenting. I mean, this, you know, AI integration aside, I think that instant messaging is really stagnated. So I love that somebody's trying to figure out a way to do something that's not iMessage or WhatsApp, but, you know, or Signal or something. But let me ask you this. I'm an old person, I guess. John mentioned he's in a bunch of group chats that have hundreds of people in them. I'm like, I'm in one with my family. I don't have any of these group chats.
No. Well, that's what a number of people said is, who wants that?
Right.
Some people have this, though. There's people who do this all the time, or that's kind of their social thing is instead of a Facebook group, it's a big group messaging chat.
And that's what we've argued in the past. That's when you should just open up your own Slack channel or your own Discord or something like that, you know?
Yeah. I want asynchronous. I don't want people dinging my phone.
Yeah. Anyway, it's fine. I wish he'd said up front, hey, here's something I'm an advisor on and I'm getting compensated by. I wouldn't have read the 4,000 world article about it. Okay.
Prediction.
I joined it. Anyway, yes.
Is our large language back models in 6 months or a year?
Yes.
Will they be a laughing stock and not unlike?
I keep asking this
Web
question.
Three?
I have asked it on almost every show in the 2 weeks since ChatGPT-4 came out. Is this a parlor trick? Or is this, as many have said, including Bill Gates, who said this is the biggest thing that happened in computing since the graphic user interface?
But then he also said that his former company was ridiculous to say that it had hints of.
It's not AGI. It's not AGI.
It's not.
And it never. And it's, I think there's a lot of reason to say maybe it never will be. But I think it is. It's in. Look how many startups. If you go search, I don't know what it is like on the Google Play Store, but if I search the Apple iOS App Store for AI, there's dozens of apps that are taking the ChatGPT API and making, you know, $2 apps.
So what's your answer? Parlor trick or no? Or revolution?
I don't know. That's why I keep asking the question. What do you think, Glenn? Fresh meat.
I think it's a fad. I think it's a fad.
Yeah.
And it's
amen.
But it'll break apart. Like, do you remember Segway? I've been on these shows too often now. Like, Segway was supposed to change the way cities were built, and it turned out to be a really good vehicle for meter readers and rent-a-cops
and mall cops.
Mall cars. But Segway is actually a kind of extraordinary thing, and I think it gave rise to that whole.
I own
that
two at home.
The thing that killed Segway is the same thing that killed
the Google Glass, which is you look like an ass on it.
Yeah.
You're like a giraffe. You're 8 feet tall, zipping around. It's very dumb. But
I think it actually gave rise to the what do they call the hoverboards that burst into flame, and then that generation gave rise. But then that gave rise to the generation of battery powered scooters that are actually pretty cool, and the unicycle self balancing wheels I see around Seattle. So ultimately, it was not the promise of the Segway wasn't revealed as all cities are going to change to build around it. But electric bikes, electric scooters, I think it did prompt a rethinking about modes of electric powered and sometimes self-balancing transportation.
Because you live in Seattle, you have a slightly warped point of view over this.
Wait, doesn't everybody ride a self-balancing unicycle?
I see them every once in a while. It's very strange. I do think you're right,
though. All over Santa Rosa.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a certain type of young man who likes to ride those. But I do see e-bikes everywhere. In fact, I just saw an article that e-bikes are really catching on in the U.S.
You have Segways and e-bikes, and you're asking about ChatGPT's future.
But you know why e-bikes were acceptable when Segways weren't? You look like you're a normal person because you're riding a bicycle.
Oh, yeah.
True.
That's right. Or a scooter, right? Even an electric-powered scooter is, at some level, it's different than a Segway, obviously, but it has a similar functionality. So ChatGPT, I don't think, and all the AI-based chat things, how useful are they in a general sense? I think not that much, but I think this is kind of like, what was the Apple Watch? I don't know. Apple didn't know what it was. It turned out it's for fitness. I think chat interactive AI models will wind up being useful for some specific stuff that's like as a reporter, I'll tell you, and there's so many people in jobs where they have to do this scut work, and the scut work is just kind of putting stuff into forms and kind of doing this thing. It's automated work that computers can't precisely do. And I could see a role for write me the form letter, an outline, and put in the blanks for blah, and it would produce something relatively original. It wouldn't be boring, and I'd go in and fill those blanks in. That seems like a perfectly reasonable use.
But that's not going to eliminate gazillions of jobs, is it?
No, it's augmentation. It makes you a little more efficient. You're better at your job. It takes you less time. It's less frustrating. It increases loyalty to a job. It lets you do higher level work. All the things that robotics did.
I put that along the same lines of creators using AI to just do some repetitive tasks a little bit more efficiently and faster, not necessarily taking away their job, if you will.
I'm totally impressed with what people are doing with Midjourney and Stable Diffusion. And I think we're going to see video created by this stuff. But it's Richard Campbell, I think, who had the most salient point of view, or one of our hosts on Windows Weekly. He said, we are in the Gartner hype cycle. This is the graph that shows the Gartner hype cycle. And we're at the beginning of a technology trigger on our way up to the peak of inflated expectations.
How long before we reach that peak?
Then there's the trough of disillusionment, where everybody goes, we overhyped to this BS. Then there is a little bit of a long tail. I think this is what you're talking about with the segue, where you reach not quite as inflated a height, but the plateau of productivity, where after a while there is some value to this. And I think that's actually fairly accurate. We get ready. Richard said, in a couple of months, we'll be hitting the trough of disillusionment. I think that's probably the
end. Haven't we done that already, though? We've gone the peak and the trough several times with it. It's like, it's trying to steal Kevin Roos from his wife. And then, all right, maybe it's not that bad.
You're right. I don't know where exactly maybe that letter is part of the peak of inflated expectations as much as
it's the roller coaster of disillusionment.
But there's clearly some value to it. Google has released Bard. If you guys had a chance to play with Bard, it came out before our show last week, but I hadn't accessed it.
More limited.
It's not impressive. It really
is wrong. Hallucinate's the wrong word, I think. It just simply doesn't know a lot and gets it wrong as a result.
Let me try your Wordle prompt. Do you know any five-letter words. I'm going to have to get faster at typing. That's one of the revelations all of this is. Where the second...
Well, a computer could do that. A computer could do that for you.
Type I should actually dictate it, shouldn't I?
Yeah, exactly.
The letter, that's what I do at home. Yeah, is U, and the fifth letter is O. Let's see if it does a better job than ChatGPT did. Was this GPT 3 or 5 or 4? Do you know?
Was it 3.5 Bing, maybe. Or something? Some people have access
to I'll try 4 with this as well.
I'm pretty sure that's ChatGPT 3.
Yeah, that's the early one. Okay.
Do you know any 5 letter words?
Let me, while we're doing this, while we're waiting, let's go to ChatGPT, and I will set it to 4 and do the same thing.
How much do you pay? What's the basic fee for?
I think it's $20 a month or something. I ended up paying for a lot of these just so that we could use them on the shows.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, one example of a five-letter word that meets your criteria is gumbo. That's right.
All right.
But just one. Let's see if Bard gets it.
Jeff
Jarvis gave us some Latin. These are...
Wow.
Yeah.
Auduo, to hear. Is that an English word? Aurum, gold. I think those are Latin words.
That's Latin.
And aurore...
Dawn,
I think those are Latin. And only
maybe
the first one is right.
It by saying Wordle, sir.
You didn't say you wanted. He did say five-letter words, and it gave him a six-letter word.
Yeah, and there is no U. I mean, there's a U, but there's no. The only one with O is a Auduo.
Oh my God.
So okay, Bard. I mean, clearly gumbo is the right. It might be the only answer. Actually, was it? Was it gumbo?
I think it was. Oh, yeah. With the.
That's pretty good. That's a hard one.
But
so if you're going to try to cheat on Wordle, you should use ChatGPT-4.
You know, Jeff has been kicking around the business for a little while, according to his publicity photos.
Hey, I'm not that old.
Yeah.
Got some publicity photos to show you, and not this time. And, you know, I was thinking, you know, if you were a reporter in 1985, 1995, 2005, 2015, today, like the amount of work it would take you to do certain kinds of stories over that time, I don't think someone looking at that would say, oh, no, the internet has stolen this person's job. Maybe it took 10 people to do something in 1985 that one person could do today, and maybe... these AI-assisted things could make that even fewer people. So,
really good point, Glenn. And newspapers would have died a lot sooner without this technology, right? As you know, Glenn Kirschenbaum's track changes, what word processing did to writing and the jobs it got rid of in the keystrokes that were not captured, in the design strokes that were not captured, the mailroom, the ITU, all those unions, very bad for all of them. But it kept newspapers alive longer.
Right, but we don't have decreased... our big problem is wage stagnation in America, the growth of wages, not employment. You know, if you look at employment curves, we didn't go through, as technology waves came through, massive waves of unemployment. We went through ever-increasing waves of displacement and employment, but we don't pay people enough. You know, it's a billionaire problem, not a job or productivity problem. If I can get all economical, I don't know.
Well, so it's interesting. I think we are in I'm going to be agnostic because I don't know. I really don't know. But I think you probably are right that this is nothing to fear.
What was it that Stallman said? Seems like
maybe I like Richard Stallman's take on it. Yeah, let me read that for you.
What?
It was actually taken down by Reddit by the time I found it on the rundown.
Oh, really?
What did he say?
It was it's just a short paragraph, but I think it's fairly. Oh, yeah. It was taken.
I don't know why.
Well, that's weird.
It's Richard Stallman. Probably someone found something.
Oh, yeah. Maybe Richard sued him. I don't know. Let me see. I'll go somewhere else.
Reddit isn't fully running free software. If it's not running free software, it's illegal to put my words on it.
Somebody said it can't be Stallman. It didn't use the word proprietary.
Well, here's the good news. Elon Musk has allowed it on Twitter. Here is an email response when asked about ChatGPT. Richard Stallman, the creator of the GNU project, writer of Emacs, and notorious curmudgeon and woman hater, says, I can't foretell the future. But it is important to realize that ChatGPT is not artificial intelligence. It has no intelligence. It doesn't know anything and doesn't understand anything. It plays games with words to make plausible sounding English text, but any statements made in it are liable to be false. It can't avoid that. because it doesn't know what the words mean.
Exactly.
That's actually really accurate. I think
nice
that's right.
Works, Mr. Stahl.
I wonder
nice
if it works. Was written by ChatGPT,
that's
though.
What now, that's I my suspicion. If he's going to say it wasn't written by him.
Yeah.
Yep. Irony.
Although, that's just how OpenAI did it. There's no reason that you couldn't. I mean, the way ChatGPT and all of these large language models work, in short, in a simplified way, is like autocorrect. They have weights for the next word that should follow the current word, and they put it together. They don't understand the meaning, but they can make it sound very cogent because those weights are based on billions of, you know, pieces of text. But they don't at any point, it doesn't understand it, so it can't evaluate it as to its accuracy. However, I don't think there's any reason you couldn't write that in to the algorithm and say, oh, and by the way, please evaluate for accuracy at the end of each sentence.
That's something. An entirely different routine then.
Yeah, but, well, there's nothing
and it's
got to
understand what
that.
An assertion of fact is.
I think it could do that.
I don't know.
I think that's just something that OpenAI didn't do.
I haven't seen any fact. After the last 6 years, you'd think you'd see a whole bunch of fact-checking programs, and I haven't seen them.
Oh, that's a good point. That's a good point.
Yeah, I mean, this is a different, you know, there's the other way around is there's like two ways around how this could be used. I think in a more typical fashion is it could be used as a drafting tool, a tool that helps you explore knowledge, gives you stuff to draft with links that let you then read more. Like it's like a super wiki, right? It's like a ultra wiki. You can't trust it necessarily, but if you have enough links, you can go and read up and enhance it. But it could also do the reverse, which Jeff is just talking about too, is I would love to feed something I wrote into a thing that looked for sources and said, actually, I found something that contradicts this conclusion. Even though it doesn't know what the conclusion is, it knows sets of words and can see if it can find similar sets of words, the negation of them, and give me that. Or even look for stuff and find citations to say, this seems to support your contention. Then we're sort of, you know, answer searching, like I make a contention and then I want the support for it. But there are ways in which that could help. I mean, I use Grammarly for my writing. I got to a certain point where I realized I lack the ability to self-proofread well enough for the kinds of submissions I do. So I feed everything through Grammarly, and it's got a little bit of AI logic in there. It's not anything as much as the large language models, but I could see a ever improved version of Grammarly making my writing drafts become crisper and crisper without the involvement of an editor when I don't have the access to one.
Well,
but how much is writing a part of people's jobs? I guess that's the question. Is it a huge part of many people's jobs? I'm very biased.
I think there are a lot of jobs where writing is not the primary job, but it is a corollary. You know, if you're an executive or even a middle manager, you spend a lot of time writing. Even police officers spend a lot of time writing. And all of those people, I think, could benefit from some mediocre, low-level, you know, average quality writing that does a good job of synopsizing. That's what ChatGPT seems best at, by the way, synopsizing stuff. Because then it's not asked to hallucinate. I decided not to use the word hallucinate anymore. Because
who
that's another anthropomorphism.
The key phrase.
But it's a human
AI
thing,
people,
right?
Maybe?
Factual error.
It screwed up.
Yeah, but it's,
it screwed up here.
See, I think that's important to understand. Lying. Just as Stallman has said, is it didn't. It's just continuing with the autocorrect. But as it does more of that, it's more likely that errors will creep in because it's not checking for those. So... Right. It's not on you. It's just what happens after a period of time. It degrades. You know, your likelihood of having factual errors is higher. I have to say though, when it's summarizing a document, it doesn't have a chance to make errors because again, that sounds I'm anthropomorphizing.
Mm-hmm.
It can't fail as much because it's got a primary text it's working from. I don't know. It sure was wrong with Wordle.
I still say you probably needed to add a qualifier to your query there.
To my bar query?
For Wordle, something like
Why?
That. Why? Well, because it gave you six-letter words. At least you gave it a reference of Wordle.
But I said five-letter words.
But it gave you some six-letter words.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the point.
It doesn't count. We know that.
Yeah, that's right. Math is not part of prediction, which is a funny problem. 2.2 plus 2 is usually 4, but in some texts, people say it's 5. So it's possible sometimes you'd get an engine saying 2 + 2 = 5 because sometimes people use that as an example of something that's not true.
I'm waiting.
Yeah, I guess that's the thing. If you ingest a corpus of things that includes things that are not true as examples or intentionally false, then of course you're going to get intentionally false answers from auto-predictive random derived text or generated text.
All right, I'm putting the U and O in quotes, and per your recommendation, I'm using the word Wordle. What is a Wordle answer where the second letter is U and the fifth letter is O? Do you think that qualification will help it be a little... a little better. This is Bard.
That would not be.
One,
nope.
Two, three.
Blurt. Blurt. Nope.
But there's a Google it button. So that is what Google said in the New York Times today that would
that's
solve.
That's what they want you to do.
I think that's what they said.
I'm Googling it. Let's see. Here's the click, Google.
Yeah, Brian X. Chen did a piece for the New York Times. That's out just today where he tried to see if he could use Bard and I think it was just, was it Bard and ChatGPT, maybe a later version of it, as a virtual assistant, even though it can't book stuff for you. He said, like, I want to go to Taipei and have a day to recover and then do some business meetings. So he tried some scenarios, and it was interesting just to see at this point what kinds of results you could get from a generalized chat one. But one of them was Google said, well, it gives you a Google it link. So even if it doesn't give you enough information, you just click that, and that'll get you more information.
Catch all right there.
Yeah, we're not quite ready.
There are 10 five-letter words with U and O. Audio, curio, gumbo, guano, gusto, jumbo, junto, outdo, outgo, and turbo. But a human figured that one out.
Google is saying, I did my job here with Bard.
Yeah, that was the Google
result. I got
you
to the right spot.
Yeah. Guano, by the way, was the right answer.
Bat guano.
Bat guano. Wasn't that like in Horseman Bojack or something? Bojack Horseman.
Bojack Horseman.
Isn't that a character?
It's in Dr. Strangelove. Look, Sergeant Bat Guano, or whatever it says on his.
If that really is your name.
That's it.
So, Leo, I don't want to
change the subject.
Of course, here.
Please.
Well, yeah, I'm not doing that. I'm just trying to augment here. ChatGPT released a whole bunch of plugins.
That actually is quite interesting.
It is. Steve Wolfram wrote about it, about how they're using it.
Yep.
I can't figure out how some of the others are using it. I wonder about it as an
I'll give you some examples. I don't yet have access, but there are quite a few plugins. OpenTable's one. So you could then say to ChatGPT, make me a reservation, and it could do that. Expedia. Same
but on
thing.
What basis does it do that? That's what I'm trying to understand.
Well, it interacts.
It doesn't know anything.
Yeah, but it can interact with, you know, so it's interesting. For instance, I've seen a lot of people say, and I guess I'm noticing it because I'm about to go on vacation, that it uses ChatGPT to plan. Like I can do, let me do one real quickly just to give you an example.
Oh, itineraries.
Yeah. So plan a day trip to Rome. Mm. April 22nd, 9 a to 5 p with a stop for lunch. And then it would be smart enough. Actually, this is pretty good. it stopped for lunch and it would be smart enough perhaps to integrate with OpenTable for that. This is, you know what, let me cut and paste this because I want to put this in my itinerary.
Yeah, there you go.
9 a.m. start your day by visiting the Colosseum, one of the most iconic landmarks in Rome. You can buy tickets online in advance to avoid long queues. Again, if it were connected through a plug-in, it could do that, right? 11 a.m. after visiting the Colosseum, see, it gave me 2 hours. That's about right. Walk to the nearby Roman Forum and Palatine Hill. These ancient ruins offer a glimpse into the city's rich history and architecture. 1 o'clock, a break for lunch at a traditional trattoria or pizzeria. Some popular options near the Colosseum are Ristorante Pizzeria Luzzi or Osteria. I have no idea if these are real. De 40. After lunch, head to the Vatican City.
That's not quarantine, but it's not too far.
The quarantine restaurant. Let's just see if there is such a thing.
I think it's the 40th something.
There is no osteria, but there is a Taverna de 40.
That's something in the 40th. The 40th.
So it may, that is not a real restaurant.
Hilarious.
So it made that
well,
up.
It would be hard, but that means that you can't say that it's not a good restaurant.
Well, yeah, I guess that's fair. Let me just see if the
so the Wolfram Alpha plugin, ChatGPT puts a query to Wolfram Alpha. Now that is an interesting connection because we know Wolfram Alpha has the
because it's got the math.
It's so hard to it's so hard to compose queries for Wolfram Alpha.
Right,
I find it. Yeah, I would love. That's actually great. Use an easier tool to compose queries for a harder tool that's hard to compose queries for.
Right.
It's very strange,
right.
But it works. If it works, then great.
Another great one is Zapier, because Zapier can be used to create now further scripts.
Mm.
So I think that there's a lot of there's a lot of potential with these plugins.
Well, it seems like there's a lot of frustration with tools that were promised more of. So there's some excitement about this because it seems it gives the veneer of working really well. So 10 years into Siri and, you know, Google Assistant and some other tools, some are better than others, but they're dissatisfying in various ways. And so being able to go to a tool that pretends to give you, doesn't know it's pretending, something that seems plausible, I think has a like an endorphin response. You're like, ah, it gave me an answer. It understood what I meant. It wasn't saying like, ah, you mean fig Newtons or whatever the Newton joke was. Fig egg freckles. That was the Newton joke, right?
Let us take a break. Then we'll talk about the Internet Archive. Did we talk about that last week? I can't remember. I don't think we did. They lost. They lost their court case.
I have thoughts.
Yes.
I thought we did.
You know, you have the same problem I have, Ant, which is I cannot remember. We have so many different shows. I know we talked about it on Twitter.
I think we talked about what was going to, because
some of
it
cross-pollinates.
Internet Archive.
Too many shows. No, the judgment came out Friday. So yeah, we talked about the fact that it was, we now have a result. The judge has.
Oh, now we have the results. Yeah. Okay.
We will also talk about a pioneer of the technology revolution who passed this past week.
Two of them.
And a TikTok ban. Where does it stand these days? And the secret list of Twitter VIPs, none of which, which does not include any of us. None of us. Cat Turd 2. VIP, but he balanced that with AOC. Anyway, we'll talk about that. Lots more to come. It's so nice to have you, Mr. Glenn Fleischman. Glenn.fun.
Thank you very much.
You know what I was going to do before the show today is look up your appearance on Jeopardy, your appearances on Jeopardy, and play one of them. Are they online anywhere?
Technically, no, but they may be findable. Sony Pictures Entertainment.
I know they would take it down immediately.
They're pretty good. They've been doing more. I watched an episode of Jeopardy the night. We started watching it more regularly again recently, where this person started and you thought, wow, she's doing terribly. She is answering wrong. She's going into the negative. And then she staged a comeback I've never seen before and wound up winning the episode. Then she lost, unfortunately, on the next because she missed a Daily Double answer. But it's still an exciting show. It's funny.
I watch it every night. I watch two episodes as I row. Here is Glenn.
What do you think of the current
host? $15,199.
Look at that.
And was that the right answer in Final
that was
Jeopardy?
Correct answer.
Yeah.
Yeah. The clue was something about, and I didn't know the answer. This is inductive reasoning, right? The clue was something about this city in Eastern Germany changed its name or had a different name between like 1955 and 1989. And I'm like, it's not Stalin. There was Stalingrad. It's not Lenin. There was Leningrad. I'm like, it has to be Karl Marx. And it was Karl Marxstadt, which is the city of Chemnitz is the name that it had before and after that. But so I just wrote, who is Karl Marx? And they were like, yep, that's it. And
you actually put a question mark after it, which is great. You're not required to do that, but okay.
That's right. Who is Karl Marx?
Am I right? Am I wrong?
So it's not Lenin. It's not Stalin. It's that era.
In my experience watching Jeopardy, that is often the skill because they always throw in little clues in the way they phrase the question and stuff. So the skill of doing a little reasoning around it, even if you don't know exactly the answer, is often enough to get you the answer. Yeah. I find.
I'd say the last several years, the big change in the game is betting strategy, is people have gone all in the last 7 years and really understanding how to be, a pro, not everyone, but the people who really win and win big know when to bet and how much to bet and when to not, like, not answering when you don't know the answer is a huge thing, but betting and strategically getting the daily doubles. That's how you're seeing some of these, 7-8 day winners, people winning hundreds of thousands of dollars. Mm.
Yeah. And I also noticed, thanks to Matt Amadio, that people no longer start at the top and go there down the category. Yeah. He flouted tradition. People were very upset that he would start with, I'll take Weisenheimer's for 1,000, Alex. And you can't, they haven't, this is, that's the, and it turns out you can. In fact, it's a brilliant strategy because the double jeopardies are often in the middle. And you get them off the board if you don't know the answer. Yeah.
It's changed the way the game. I don't think I could play. It's a faster and more numeric gameplay than I think it used to be. But I think they're pulling in, when they switched to all internet auditioning, I think they're pulling in wonkier people than they used to.
They sure look wonkier. I have to say.
Well, look at me.
I'm looking at the picture of you playing and thinking, that's a pretty good looking bunch there. Nowadays, some pretty strange looking people in there. There's some weirdos. You even put on a necktie for the show.
Good. The weirdos should be playing Jeopardy.
Yeah, I agree. Like the people riding their unicycles in Santa Rosa.
Exactly. Exactly.
Playing hacky sack.
Do you play hacky sack? Tell the truth.
No, I'm not one of those kinds of Seattleites.
You're not that guy. No. Our show today, I'm very happy to say, brought to you by CDW and Hewlett Packard Enterprise, HPE Greenlake, orchestrated by the experts at CDW. The helpful people at CDW understand your organization needs simple management over its big data. We know that more than ever now, right? With some needing to keep their workloads on-prem due to organizational or regulatory requirements, maybe it could be a little challenging to organize and optimize your data. That's where CDW can help your organization by consolidating and managing all your data in one flexible, unified experience with the HPE GreenLake edge-to-cloud platform. The experience you get with HPE GreenLake is unique, because no matter where your data or applications live, you can free up energy and resources with automated processes and streamlined management. I mean, who couldn't use some streamlining these days, right? Not only that, HPE GreenLake creates a seamless cloud experience among multiple data environments thanks to the as-a-service model that meets your remote workforce where they live, at the edge. And with unrivaled scalability, you'll see an instant increase in capacity, allowing for greater flexibility and accelerated business growth so your team can tackle bigger priorities like, innovation, maybe? When you need to get more out of your technology, HPE makes data transformation possible. CDW makes it powerful. Learn more at cdw.com/HPE. We thank CDW and HPE for supporting our show. cdw.com/HPE. So it was a loss. In court for the Internet Archive, we had Cory Doctorow briefly on Twit on Sunday, and he was pretty head up about all this.
Really?
He has said, as many have observed. Yeah, Cory, just a little bit. He has said, as many have observed, that the publishers are just like libraries to go away. But, of course, libraries predate publishing. Cory pointed out they literally predate books. So I guess the Library of Alexandria is mostly papyruses. There's not much they can do about it, but this was, for these four book publishers, a great opportunity for them to at least take a chink out of the libraries. Hachette versus Internet Archive. New York federal court judge heard the arguments on Monday of last week. By Friday of last week, Judge John G. Kettle decided that the Internet Archive had done nothing more than create derivative works and so would have needed authorization from the book's copyright holders, the publishers, before lending them out through its National Emergency Library Program. So, round one, to the publishers. But, of course, the Internet Archive will appeal. This one's going all the way to the Supreme Court. I have no doubt about it. In the Internet
Archive. I don't think so at all.
Oh, you don't? Think so at all. Why not?
I think it's extremely cut and dried. And I think the judge's decision was actually correct. As much as I love and respect the Internet Archive, they have no foot on which to stand with this. But they wanted to turn it into a broad, I mean, look, nobody should defend large publishers and their behavior in the marketplace or how they treat authors or how they treat libraries. This is the problem. Like, they're not solitary characters, right? Where you're like, hey, the publishers are great.
Publishers win.
Yay. It's like, we know, you know, they have their own set of problems and issues, and they've been the way in which they allow public libraries to lend ebooks is kind of ridiculous. I mean, there has to be some kind of fair balance, and they don't want to strike it. But the Internet Archive flouted a well-established law in doing what they did, and there's no basis on which they did what they did, and the judge said it. Now, what they pushed and what a lot of their advocates pushed all during the case was that publishers are going to use this to erode other rights, like Google Books, HathiTrust's abilities, one in court, to scan and offer snippet views and maintain private databases, like libraries, the right of the first lending right, or the first, I'm sorry, what's that called? It's when in the United States, when you purchase a work, purchase an item, you can do whatever you want with it once you own it. If you have a physical book, you can lend it, sell it, destroy it, first sell it. Yeah. That doctrine, the judge said, no, that doctrine is totally intact. This doesn't apply. The fair use right that the Google Books and HathiTrust lawsuit established, he didn't wave it away, but he explained how previous decisions that enlarged and codified fair use and enlarged and codified the first sale doctrine all stood in place, and how the Internet Archive's specific attempts fell outside it and failed to justify even what they're maintaining. So I think it was a weak suit.
Because they were loaning more book copies than they had, Glenn?
Well, no, it's because there's no established right to convert an electronic copy or a physical copy into an electronic copy and loan it. That was one. That's their digital lending right issue, which does not have a basis in the law. So Congress could extend the law to allow that. They could lobby for that and make that happen. It might be a good thing to do, depending on a lot of factors. And they did not have the right to loan unlimited copies during when they established that emergency during the pandemic. Were those social goods? Yes. Do I love the Internet Archive? Yes. Do I think it's legal and within the regulatory structure? No. And I don't think the judge was wrong. I think allowing publishers to engage in predatory practices with libraries instead of having you know, a lot of industries in the music recording industry, there are a lot of statutory rights that force things like, you know, any band, Leo, you could start the, you know, a tribute band and record any song you want as a cover. That's statutorily protected. And there's an amount of money you have to pay the original public, the person who wrote the music, wrote the song, the lyrics and music. But there's no similar rights for libraries. So you could argue, and, you know, in Europe, libraries in Europe have to pay specific fees that go to authors for subsequent lending rights. And it kind of obviates this whole issue.
So what I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, what I understand the Internet Archive did, and I agree with you. In fact, we had Stephen Levy and Alex Kantorowicz on Twitter a couple of weeks ago, and they argued, as you did, that the Internet Archive overstepped its authority. What the Internet Archive does or did, they would be either given books, old worn out books from libraries, or buy books. I think in the most cases they were given books by libraries, physical copies, which they could have, as a regular library would, lend out. But instead they decided to scan those, and at least initially what they did is they lent them out just as libraries lend out sanctioned ebooks, one book per reader. In other words, they wouldn't have 14 copies of the same digital book. Now, there was the emergency act during COVID where they said, we're not going to have those limits. I think that's what they did. That's what they got in trouble for.
Right.
But I do believe that the publishers also, and the judge agreed, did not want them to scan physical books and then lend those out. Those were considered derivative works, much like a cover band would be a derivative work, and was not allowed. The problem is that is a method that is in response to the fact that major publishers don't actually offer digital books for purchase to libraries. They have
many of them restrict it.
They have very high licensing fees and they rent them. It's very restrictive. So there is no way to get digital books in the same way you get print books for libraries. That's one. The publishers haven't given them a means to do that. There's also the issue of book banning and censorship. And I think there's a public interest in not only preserving these physical books by digitizing them, but also lending them out in cases where they're banned in jurisdictions. And lending them out electronically means that somebody who can't read a book, and some kid that can't read a book in Florida, can borrow it from the Internet Archive. And I think there's a societal mandate to allow that. Okay, I understand the publishers don't like it. Corey's point is the publishers aren't going to, they're not losing any money with these lendings any more than, you know, they've always claimed that libraries cost authors and publishers money. And Corey, I think, is pretty adamant that that's not the case. You disagree.
I don't think libraries don't cost authors money, but the digital lending rate surely did, because even before their emergency period that they declared, the Internet Archive didn't put strong protection on the book. So they were loaning, and this is a whole issue about DRM in books, but a loan versus a purchase. When I purchase something, I find DRM offensive because I feel like I've bought it, and often in a way that should allow me to use it. You know, and so on the movie side, Movies Everywhere. What's the system called that allows
Movies Everywhere. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that system actually broke some of the DRM issues by allowing you to use movies you purchased on any platform. You can link them across all your devices and platforms. So that sort of diffused some of that issue, which been building for a long time. It gave you more legitimate ability to work within a DRM system. I think there's a lot of ill use of DRM. And I know Corey has written about that for decades, and I don't think he's wrong about a lot of it. But when you borrow or loan something, when it's meant to be a fixed period of time, I think it's acceptable to have DRM be one of the things that controls lending. And the Internet Archive's DRM controls on its digital lending rate were not strong. And then to allow an unlimited borrowing of any number of copies of books during the period, the self-declared emergency period, also is a taking, right? And so from an intellectual property standpoint, does this hurt? I mean, does it hurt authors when people can go to the Internet Archive and get an unlimited number of books for an extended period of time? And in some cases, if they do a very simple thing, can retain that book forever. I think it's pretty clear it does.
The judge could have,
it's not a generalized
case. And I think maybe should have said, okay, that emergency lending thing, that was not okay. But I really did want the judge to uphold the first sale doctrine.
He did. He did.
But you can't digitize it. For physical only. So if I buy a book, I can't scan it.
You can scan it for personal use. You can possess it. You can do any transformatory act you want in the privacy of your home and among a household, as you can with a lot of
that makes sense.
Hey, speaking of Craig Newman, right? I was in the Newman v. The Replay TV lawsuit that was Newman V, and I was one of the non-named co-plaintiffs of that lawsuit when 29 different studios were trying to prevent fast forwarding of ads as something because Replay TV enabled it, right? And EFF pursued model litigants or model plaintiffs, and I was one of them. So we entered that lawsuit, and it was settled, so we didn't get a definitive answer. But it's the same principle as, you know, can you fast forward in the privacy of your home? Well, a studio executive said, well, there might be acceptable pausing for using the bathroom, but you're obliged to watch the ads, right? Maybe you can go take a break. It's the same kind of thing here, where it's in the privacy of your home. If you want to scan a book or transform a book, that's fine. And Google and other organizations like that, Libraries Ahati Trust, which is a kind of an association that represents hundreds and hundreds of academic libraries and institutional libraries.
Invaluable to my research. Yeah. Invaluable.
Well, in fact, the courts upheld that as fair use.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Because a machine was reading it, not a human.
Exactly. You're not making it all. It doesn't lessen the value. It doesn't. It's not a taking. I mean,
let me read what the EFF says. Mm-hmm. Four publishers sued the archive, alleging that this controlled digital lending violates their copyrights. Hachette, HarperCollins, Wiley, and Penguin Random House claim CDL has cost their companies millions of dollars and is a threat to their business. This is the EFF writing. They are wrong. Libraries have paid publishers billions of dollars for the books in their print collections, and are investing enormous resources in digitization in order to preserve those texts. CDL helps ensure the public can make full use of the books the libraries have bought and paid for. This activity is fundamentally the same as traditional library lending and poses no new harm to authors or the publishing industry. Libraries have never been required to get permissions or pay extra fees to lend books. And as a practical matter, the data shows that the CDL, has not and will not harm the publisher's bottom line. I agree with you. There's this gray area over the uncontrolled lending, but I don't understand why it's any different for a library, whether it's a Boston Public Library, which does this, or the Internet Archive, to scan a physical copy and lend that out, one book per digital copy, one reader per digital copy. That seems to me the same thing.
That seems to be very fair if you maintain that limitation.
But I don't think Glenn agrees.
I don't agree because I think you have to have strong DRM, and the Internet Archive didn't have it. And I think you have to, I also think it's not established in law. So should there be such a right? I actually think there should. Even further, I think the European model is what we should be adopting, which is that libraries should be paying. I'm not trying to take money out of libraries' budgets, but instead of having this broken ebook model where publishers charge ridiculous amounts and limit the lending to like 29 times ever for an ebook, things like that, libraries should instead be using the licensing model the European market involves, which requires payments every time books are lent out and that they go to authors and publishers. And that allows the removal of a whole overlay. It means that there's fair payment. But it doesn't involve this incredible
pressure
libraries. By publishers.
That completely undermines
libraries. No, because the libraries are paying these fees. They're paying these fees in terms of ebook lending right now.
Which is the broken system. And the whole point here is,
system.
And this is, Corey is always arguing this, that somehow because something's digital doesn't change the fundamental copyright issue, but publishers who hate the whole idea of libraries would love to say, as you are, oh, now that it's digital, we have to have DRM, we have to have licensing, we have to have fees. I completely disagree. The EFF also disagrees. They say copyright law does not prevent that lawful fair use. Indeed, it supports it. Libraries are simply striving to serve their patrons effectively and efficiently, lending books one at a time, just as they've done for centuries. The fact that it's digital versus print should make no difference. Now, I do agree with you. You're probably right. This won't make it to the Supreme Court, even though I'm sure Internet Archive will appeal it all the way. I doubt they'll get certiorari because, you know, copyright holders have undue, disproportionate influence in this society. But,
yes,
you know, this is, yeah, this undermines how libraries work fundamentally, and it's wrong.
I don't think it undermines it at all because it puts us back into the status quo ante in which libraries are doing exactly what they've been doing. I think it reaffirms the publisher's position, which I think is predatory, that I don't like. So what I would prefer is instead of the Internet Archive attempting to stake out an untenable position, which they did, which the law doesn't support, that they should be working to get reform. I mean, the endless extension of the copyright law.
There is some disagreement over whether the law supports it or not. So that's...
Well, so let me ask you a hypothetical. Let me ask you a question. Because I looked up the library, the Internet Archive, and they said they need some books. And I was looking up for this purpose. I was looking up to see if I had any to give to them, and they didn't need my books. A library pays full retail for a physical book, right? Is there anything in first sale that prevents me from giving the library a copy of a book so they don't have to pay for it and they can then lend that out, right?
No, not at all, right? So
then libraries can't. That's the other principle at work here,
right?
Is that number one. Number two, I think that what needs to get challenged is that when I buy an Audible book, which I do a lot, I can't give it to someone else, even with DRM.
Yeah, this is the publishers love the idea that
I can't give a Kindle book to somebody else.
Now that it's digital, we can retrade the agreement.
They've rewritten first sale doctrine in these new areas.
They hate first sale doctrine. They want to charge for every copy of the book.
Yes, there should be.
Yeah, you should be able to transfer. If I could transfer my ebook ownership to someone else, I would feel very differently about publishers, and I can't. I'll tell you, do you remember when iTunes was introduced? I was interviewing Phil Schiller. This is 2005, 5 or 4. And this is when everything else was, you had to buy, it was all this protection and downloads. It was a very complicated music system. And Phil said to me, unlike these other systems, when you buy a song from Apple, you own it. And I said, oh, can I sell it to somebody else? And he said, no. I'm like, well, then I don't own it, right? I'm licensing it. It's a license. Right. Yeah. And that's the thing. If I buy an ebook, I'm not really buying it. It's a license. And I I've always agreed with Corey on that. The same token, if I buy a physical book, am I buying the rights to reproduce it electronically or in any form? I'm not under the current law. Should I be able to? Probably, right? Congress should copyright be endless? Should libraries be subject to the same strictures that individual purchases are? There's a lot of change that should happen. And I don't think this was the mechanism that allows that. I think it did reaffirm publishers' positions, but it also means that we really have to go to legislature and get changes made. Is it possible? I don't know if it is, but I think that's the route that would actually produce a lasting and change without requiring lawsuit after lawsuit.
All right, let's take a little break. When we come back, there's more to talk about. That's a great subject. You, by the way, are in the same camp as Stephen Levy and Alex Kantorowicz, all three of you authors. Corey's an author. Jeff, you're an author. I have no books in this hunt. But I think libraries are one of the most...
any book I sell.
Yeah, good for you. Good. So, awesome. Your publisher might. And Corey actually... Corey has a...
I'm the publisher.
There you go. Corey has a new Kickstarter, by the way, and I love the title of the Kickstarter. Red Team Blues, another audiobook that Amazon won't sell. And his point is because he will not put DRM on his audiobooks, Amazon, i.e. Audible, will never carry his audio. And I said, but really, isn't that a case of you not letting them carry it? He said, no, because they insist on a DRM.
Okay. He's the license holder. He's the publisher in this case, and he's not letting that.
Okay, Corey. But no, his point is well taken, and it is the longest URL I've ever seen on a Kickstarter. But you know what? Easiest thing to do, go to Kickstarter.com, search for Red Team Blues. Looks like a really great book. This is Corey's bid to own a James Bond-like series. His hero in the book is a certified public accountant. And Marty Hench knows where Silicon Valley's bodies are buried. He's a hard-charging forensic accountant, a gentleman of a certain age who spent the past 40 years unwinding every finance scam in Silicon Valley. If we can just make him a little younger and sexier, Corey, I think we could have movie rights sold. I'm just saying. I see maybe one of the Hemsworth brothers. I'm just saying, can we make him a little younger? Red Team Blues on Kickstarter. We will be back in a moment. Hey, everybody. Leo Laporte here. I am the founder and one of the hosts at the TWIT Podcast Network. I want to talk to you a little bit about what we do here at TWIT, because I think it's unique. And I think for anybody who is bringing a product or a service to a tech audience, you need to know about what we do here at TWIT. We've built an amazing audience of engaged, intelligent, affluent listeners who listen to us and trust us when we recommend a product. Our mission statement as TWIT is to build a highly engaged community of tech enthusiasts. Wait, already you should be, your ears should be perking up at that, because highly engaged is good for you. Tech enthusiasts, if that's who you're looking for, this is the place. We do it by offering them the knowledge they need to understand and use technology in today's world. And I hear from our audience all the time, part of that knowledge comes from our advertisers. We are very careful. We pick advertisers with great products, great services, with integrity, and introduce them to our audience with authenticity and genuine enthusiasm. And that makes our Host Red ads different from anything else you can buy. We are literally bringing you to the attention of our audience and giving you a big, fat endorsement. We like to create partnerships with trusted brands, brands who are in it for the long run, long-term partners that want to grow with us. And we have so many great success stories. Tim Broom, who founded IT Pro TV in 2013, started advertising with us on day one, has been with us ever since. He said, quote, "We would not be where we are today without the TWIT network." I think the proof is in the pudding. Advertisers like IT Pro TV and Audible that have been with us for more than 10 years. They stick around because their ads work. And honestly, isn't that why you're buying advertising? You get a lot with Twit. We have a very full service attitude. We almost think of it as kind of artisanal advertising, boutique advertising. You'll get a full service continuity team. People who are on the phone with you, who are in touch with you, who support you with everything from copywriting to graphic design. So you are not alone in this. We embed our ads into the shows. They're not added later. They're part of the shows. In fact, often they're such a part of our shows that our other hosts will chime in on the ad saying, yeah, I love that. Or just the other day, one of our hosts said, man, I really got to buy that. That's an additional benefit to you because you're hearing people our audience trusts saying, yeah, that sounds great. We deliver, always over deliver on impressions. So you know you're going to get the impressions you expect. The ads are unique every time. We don't pre-record them and roll them in. We are genuinely doing those ads in the middle of the show. We'll give you great onboarding services. AdTech with PodSites, that's free for direct clients, gives you a lot of reporting, gives you a great idea of how well your ads are working. You'll get courtesy commercials. You actually can take our ads and share them across social media and landing pages. That really extends the reach. There are other free goodies too, including mentions in our weekly newsletter that's sent to thousands of fans, engaged fans who really want to see this stuff. We give you bonus ads and social media promotion too. So if you want to be a long-term partner, introduce your product to a savvy, engaged tech audience. Visit twit.tv/advertise. Check out those testimonials. Mark McCrary is the CEO of Authentic. You probably know him, one of the biggest original podcast advertising companies. We've been with him for 16 years. Mark said the feedback from many advertisers over 16 years across a range of product categories, everything from razors to computers, is that if ads and podcasts are going to work for a brand, they're going to work on Twitch shows. I'm very proud of what we do because it's honest, it's got integrity, it's authentic, and it really is a great introduction to our audience of your brand. Our listeners are smart, they're engaged, they're tech savvy, they're dedicated to our network. And that's one of the reasons we only work with high integrity partners that we've personally and thoroughly vetted. I have absolute approval on everybody. If you've got a great product, I want to hear from you. Elevate your brand by reaching out today at advertise@twit.tv. Break out of the advertising norm. Grow your brand with host-read ads on twit.tv. Visit twit.tv/advertise for more details, or you can email us advertise@twit.tv if you're ready to launch your campaign now. I can't wait to see your product. So give us a ring. Now we're back, and it's time to talk TikTok. Do we have a TikTok corner, Jeff?
Oh, no.
Do we have a TikTok corner? TikTok, in its testimony, the CEO of TikTok testified. This could be your number. I don't want to steal your number. That the hashtag TikTok ban had 1.7 billion views on Monday.
As of Monday, yeah.
As of Monday. He also said, and I don't have the number in front of me, but he said a rather large number for the number of videos they take down every day. It was in the at least millions, if not billions, for a variety of reasons that they are trying really hard to keep people safe on TikTok. But I don't think lawmakers or state governments really care about the hashtag.
No, they don't.
TikTok.
Line 59, ban. I put in one thing here from
TikTok, ladies TikTok. And gentlemen. A random, I think I know which stupid, is this the Wi-Fi moment?
Yeah. Actually it's not. No, it's different.
That was another random stupid moment. Let's see.
That was hilarious.
That was the one where a member of Congress asked Chu, the CEO of TikTok, do you attach to my Wi-Fi? And he said, well, yeah, when your app's at home, can you see my Wi-Fi? Yeah, that's how it works. I rest my case, Your Honor. Okay, here's another one.
It's a series of tubes. It's a bunch of tubes, and you have to
plug
the TikTok into the tube.
Mr. Carter from Georgia. ladies and gentlemen. Oh, my sound is turned off. I always do that. Hold on a second. I got to do this right. Got to hear every juicy adverb coming out of this member of Congress. Here, press the button. Do the thing. Here we go.
I want to talk specifically. Can you tell me right now, can you say with 100% certainty that TikTok does not use the phone's camera to determine whether the content that elicits a pupil dilation should be amplified by the algorithm? Can you tell me that?
We do not collect body, face, or voice data to identify our users.
They don't need to. They just say, how long do you watch it?
How long are you on the screen?
I think, you like this bikini-rich pupil content.
Dilation.
More thirst traps.
We do not. The only face data that you will get that we collect is when you use the filters to have, say, sunglasses on your face. We need to know where your eyes are.
Why do you need to know where the eyes are if you're not seeing if they're dilated? And
that data is stored on
your
local device. What is this?
Oh my gosh.
If you use it for facial.
Well, sunglasses on, so I can't see them.
Collect body, face, or voice data to identify our users.
I find that hard to believe.
There you go. I find it hard. And because I find that hard to believe.
They're all hard to believe. Did it come off as a bit racist a time or two as well?
What were they? Was there racism as well?
Really?
Well, I mean, it a couple of times, because I've bounced in and out of it, and it sort of pissed me off.
It was making me so angry, I turned it off.
They kept sort of referring to him as if he's Chinese.
Yeah.
He's from Singapore.
Yeah. And he went to Harvard,
and I
want to
say
Christ
at one
sake.
Point, he was like, hey, sir, I'm Singaporean. I want to say he said that at least once.
Well, you look like you're Chinese.
It's like, wow.
Well, I think that you could say,
coital silver.
So too much what? Coital silver.
Yes, that's it's great for the health. Apparently, this is not a recommendation. It's one of these right wing things that people do. They they drink colloidal silver. Some people have turned blue. Haven't you seen the pictures of people?
Oh yeah.
Sorry, it's not.
I had a whole different picture because I thought you said coital silver, and that's another.
No, not coital silver.
Coital silver.
Colloidal. Wow, Ant, I got you.
Good. Yep, silver. You did. Good pull, sir.
Okay.
Good
pull. Certain parts of the country know more than others about these.
I mean, in some ways, you could say that the whole TikTok thing is racist because it's if it weren't Chinese, right?
I mean, xenophobic at the least.
It's at least xenophobic. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Could have had Snap and Instagram and TikTok all up there. Facebook
should have.
Live.
Should have. And the only thing I heard sensible coming from some of the members of Congress was we need a law, a privacy law.
Well, and whose job is that?
Yeah. So do it. Go do it.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of what they were asking of Chu was to do things that they're not asking of Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and all the others. And I think his point was, we could do that, but it would put us at a huge competitive disadvantage. And I think this really underscores the fact that this is what Facebook wants. I wouldn't be surprised at all if, you know, Mark Zuckerberg weren't whispering into these members of Congress' ears, hey, you know, you should really do something about TikTok. They're really eating our lunch. Twitter's source code has been hanging around in public for months. Leaked online, Elon Musk has gone to GitHub saying, who did that? Probably, I'm guessing, a disgruntled former employer. Twitter was able to get the source code pulled off GitHub on Friday with a copyright infringement notice. It's unclear how long, according to the New York Times, the leaked code had been online, but it appears to have been public for at least several months. Which just shows
not long enough for someone to fix it.
Twitter asked the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California to order GitHub to identify the person who shared the code and everybody who downloaded it. Elon's coming to your house, kids.
Come on over. Let's have a beer. But that's it.
One concern, of course, is code includes security vulnerabilities that could give hackers or other motivated partners the means to extract user data or take down the site. Actually,
I don't think there's any worse you could do to Twitter with their source code than they've done with them themselves.
They've self-imposed. And in fact, I think the Armageddon is probably coming on Saturday. When
oh, really?
well, April 1st, Elon has said that we are going to start removing blue checks from everybody who doesn't pay. Right?
Wild. April Fool's yeah. Day.
And if you don't have a blue check, you won't ever be shown in the For You column. You won't be able to participate in polls. And it's he's been kind of implying that if you have the blue check, your posts will be boosted. So honestly, I mean, I don't know who's still on Twitter. Apparently quite a few people. But isn't this going to make it just be unusable? Maybe not. People seem to really not want to leave Twitter. They really don't want to leave
it's,
Twitter.
It's a broadcast platform for some of us.
Yeah, but if you don't have a blue check, so you're going to pay him an $8? $8?
No, I'm not paying him squat. Okay. But
so you won't be a very good. If, it won't be as good a broadcast.
If I don't see it's being useful for me, then no, I'll dump it.
Your impressions are going to go down, I would think.
Platform. Because there's a bunch of things out there. There's Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Vero, YouTube, whatever you want. And you try them out. And if you don't feel like they're working for you, you just leave. And Twitter at the moment still works for me. And if it stops working for me, I won't put any more effort into it because I know that game has been fixed.
I do have to point out that, yes, Elon Musk does have a blue check, but apparently
it's legacy.
It may or may not be notable. So,
oh, man, he's too cheap to pay himself.
He's not even paying the $8 himself, kids.
Got to sell some more houseplants for the offices to afford that.
Can you believe that?
That's hilarious.
This is a legacy verified account. It may or may not be notable. By the way, I just want to point out, I have a better blue check than Elon does because my blue check says this account is verified because it's notable in government, news, entertainment, or another designated category. So I guess I trump Elon.
But now I can't wait to get rid of my blue check because it's the mark of the $8 schmuck.
Yeah, I'll be very interested. I'm going to be on vacation when I lose my blue check. I guess I should hope I lose it, right?
Because I wonder if you'll even lose it, though.
I bet I won't.
Because, again, it says you're notable.
Everybody's
right going
to think you're an Elon suck-up then.
Uh-huh.
I did pay when Twitter Blue first came out before Elon's acquisition. Yeah. I did pay for it.
Yeah, I did too.
Yeah, me too. I did too.
Oh, okay, okay, so there's a new kind of blue check. This account is verified because it's subscribed to Twitter Blue.
All right.
So,
and I hate seeing it.
So that's how that works. So
what was the thing too is that the engineers are working on being able to let you suppress showing your check mark so people won't think you're a schmuck.
Somebody saw this in the code. It has not been confirmed, but somebody saw it in the code.
I love that
there will be a setting that says, I know I have the blue check, but I don't want anybody to see it.
That's right.
Didn't Elon want to make the whole thing egalitarian and no princes, no paupers?
He didn't want anything like that.
That's not what.
He still want to open source the code?
Yeah,
he promised it for the end of March, didn't he?
Yeah,
he got sick. He got pissed that some of it got leaked.
That's why I asked. It's like, is that?
No, but
there?
But you they had said he said I'm going to open source the algo. He said, you may not like it. It's going to be ugly, but at least you'll get to fix it. But the problem is he's fired everybody who knows how to do that, I think. There's no engineering bandwidth to do what he wants to do.
Uh-huh.
He may also have realized open sourcing the algorithm is not a good idea because that just means everybody can game it. As soon as you know what gets you the top of the list, you game it. You make sure you're on the top, right?
Similar to what people have already been doing.
Right.
Apparently posting TikTok videos, then retweeting them, and then commenting on them or something is the current best strategy. There's
so
Ryan Broderick's Garbage Day. He's been writing about how he's trying to figure out how people are gaming the system.
Yeah.
And I think that's it. It's like a video, but it's not the video that gets it. It's a comment that quote tweets it, that replies to it, and those are the ones. It's weird, but it's like
it makes total sense, though. It's all engagement. That makes total sense to me.
Yeah. It's like, why were magicians all over Facebook for a while? They figured out the magic of getting engagement there with those 3-minute weird videos. And the same thing's happening on Twitter. It's going to get very weird over there.
Well, not for the Twitter VIPs. Zoe Schiffer, writing a platformer, seems to have discovered the secret list of Twitter VIPs who get boosted over everyone else. This, I guess, is a leak. I'm not sure where she got it, but LeBron James, Ben Shapiro, Cat Turd 2. Oh, then to balance it out, AOC and Joe Biden. Oh, I am a paid subscriber, but I guess I'm not signed in, so I'll have to go through that rigmarole. But I don't know. What does that mean? There's a VIP list. Of course there is. There's always been. Remember when Justin Bieber was huge on, he had his own server on Twitter because they had to have dedicated hardware, the Bieber servers. I think that's always been the case. So Anthony Nielsen says that I am not notable. I'm only notable in my own mind. That when he... when he looks at it,
wow, oh yeah. Jab.
See, when I look, so when I'm in private now, I'm not logged in. It says this is a legacy verified account. It may or may not be notable.
Oh.
So somehow, for some reason, Elon is showing me something different.
Dude, that's fascinating.
Well, that's weird.
What's that all about?
I mean, the chief twit called out the so-called chief twit, and that's what happens to you.
I think that maybe because I'm not Elon, I'm seeing that, but when... I don't know. What a sort of weird code is that?
I'm looking at my account right now. I have a legacy verified account, and it says I'm a legacy verified account. It doesn't say that I'm notable
or
not.
And you're logged in.
When I'm logged in.
Yeah.
Peculiar.
He's sucking us into this stupid game. Who cares?
Exactly. Well, it'll just make a difference in how, what happens. What's it going to be like when verification goes away? Because it's been a signal for people. Not necessarily about credibility, but it was something. It was like you trusted people were who they said they were. And I did see Isn't For You is going to include people you follow, but then how are you going to find, you're not going to be able to discover people who aren't paying to promote themselves, basically.
Yeah, and it seems to me, if you take away the blue checks from people who are actually verified, that we will be back to the way where it was when he first did this, and there was all that impersonation going on, right? So
those
anyway,
fun times.
We shall find out Saturday. Enjoy. I will be not paying any attention whatsoever to that. Because
as you shouldn't.
I will be on vacation. So all right, moving here. I finally logged in, by the way, to Platformer. Here's the rest of the list. Mr. Beast. Mark Andreessen, weird Twitter pioneer at Drill. Do you know who that is, Jeff?
Oh, yeah.
No.
Oh, you know who it is, Glenn.
Yeah.
Is it good or bad?
The guy was, there's a question whether Drill got red-pilled, which is a very modern thing to say, which is Drill not exactly a parody account. It was a pseudonymous account, and the guy posted some of the funniest, most unhinged, like weird Twitter stuff for years and years. But then at some point a few months ago, he started to post things that sounded suspiciously like maybe a slightly funnier or more tuned in Elon Musk. And people have felt like there's a whole conspiracy theory about the account, that it was sold or that someone else has taken over, or the guy behind it has decided to, go Musk or go Q, who knows what. But it's got a very different tone. He just used to post things that were incredible non sequiturs, but like tapped directly into like a very, very of the moment zeitgeist, and were just almost incomprehensible a week later. It was incredible skill.
That's what Twitter was really good at, right?
Yeah, weird
things
Twitter
like that, and
so
the horse e-books.
Horse e-books.
Yeah.
The funny thing is that Andreessen has blocked virtually everybody.
Yeah.
I don't know why I got blocked by him, but I'm blocked by him. Are you?
I got blocked years ago.
Yeah.
I think he blocked me in 1996 when I said that it was all over for Netscape once Internet Explorer 3 came out. So
it's a very thin-skinned man.
Yes. What is his? Is it just Mark Andreessen? What is his?
No, it's
P. Marca.
Oh, that's right, P. Marca. Yeah. Let me just see if I'm blocked. No, I can see his stuff. He hasn't blocked me.
Like to point out, I always do this when
he follows me. Look at that. Hi, P. Marca.
We used to be in conversations all the time.
Let's see what his... this is a new thing, by the way. When Calacanis was on Twit, I asked him, what's this all-in thing next to your name?
Yeah.
And that's the thing they pay for now. That's the A16. He's got the A16Z glyph. That's his venture capital firm. Calacanis had the all-in glyph for he tried to sell me and get a Twiglet, but no, I'm not going to purchase.
I'm glad they're happy.
He didn't give me a price, but I think
it's $1,000 a month, isn't it? Isn't that the company price?
Expensive. I think that's just for verification. I don't think it's
is that not corporate verification.
You know, you have to wear a certain amount of flair, Leo. You have to have 25 pieces of flair. That's just a recommendation.
I need some flair. I just want to say on Mastodon, you have all the flair you want, no charge.
That's right. Free flair.
Free flair. And believe it, people use it.
Outstanding.
A lot of flair up there on the Mastodon.
In fact, I just like to point out, every time Elizabeth Holmes gets in the news, I like to point out the New York Times, was it the fashion section or something? We had a cover story written by Mark Andreessen's wife, and Mark Andreessen had some connection to Theranos and was extolling Elizabeth Holmes as the future of everything. And none of the entanglements were disclosed.
Oh,
so
Lord.
There you go. All that little world talking to each other.
Also on the list, comedian Jabuki Young White. Don't know who that is. Yeah. Tesla community account, Tesla Owners SV. And journalists Matt Iglesias, Glenn Greenwald, Noah Smith, and Adrian Wojnarowski.
Can we put air quotes around journalists in this case?
Yeah. Platformer is not publishing the full list, whose makeup has changed slightly over time to protect our sources' identities. Menswear writer Derek Guy is also on the list.
Hi, Guy.
I really have to force myself to do these stories. You haven't heard a lot of Facebook stories over the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I feel the same way about Twitter at this point. It's just so many people, including Jeff and Stacy, are still, you know, Twitter users. And I feel like I guess I have to cover this. I don't know.
It has its place, you know.
I guess.
About how I look at it. Facebook has its place too. I'm not a Facebook user, but again, I've mentioned before that I know a handful of users there where their business thrives because of Facebook connections.
Yeah. Well, I understand that.
Don't shoot yourself in the foot. Yeah. When we did the Shift Happens book, by the way, Kickstarter lets you create unique URLs for, you know, a bazillion of them to track. And so we can see how Twitter performed when Marcin or I used an account I barely post to. I haven't posted hardly since November, but I've been posting promotional things when those come up, projects I'm working on. We can see how it performed relative to Mastodon and other social media, and it performed quite well.
Oh, so you
it's
keep riding
still delivering.
It. Okay.
Yeah.
So keep riding it.
Don't shoot yourself in the foot, but don't be. I'm not trying to make Twitter a better place.
No.
But I'll use it. I'll use it as long as it's valuable tool to me.
The company's still
on our Twit social.
Yeah, we still do it.
Sir.
Yeah, our social media people do it. Well, if I had the power, I would say don't, but I don't have the power to do that. I haven't posted on Twitter in ages since November.
So today I went to Fedi Forum, which was a today and tomorrow is a unconference online for folks on the Fediverse. Good folks there talking about important stuff. But let's note one thing. There wasn't a black person among the 65 people who were there. And so there are communities, that's only one of them, that are still on Twitter, and it's easy for me to move off Twitter. It's not easy for a community to move off Twitter. Mm-hmm. And I think we got to recognize that people have invested in it.
Yeah.
They have value there, and to leave and say, oh, everything's okay, almost looks like white flight to the suburbs. We're going to be a little careful here, I think.
You know, someone brought that up as well, as far as the communities, and they asked me about it. And I said, well, for me, when I go to the Fediverse side of things, it definitely looks like people are trying to build community, and and I get that. Mm-hmm. But I'm a broadcaster. My community is very, very small, and most of my community even know my phone number. You ever heard of phone numbers? Most of my community.
The white pages are in. The white pages are here.
You know, so that's where I am with this stuff, and I get that. You know, Twitter can still be used to connect a lot of people. Unfortunately, it's just a lot of a cesspool crap happening. But trying to get, say, black Twitter, more so, not black Twitter, black folks to jump to the Fediverse, I find it an interesting challenge, especially when most people are like, well,
isn't that a Facebook clone? Or isn't that a Twitter clone? Why do I want to go over there? At least every time I ask somebody that's quote unquote normal and black about the Fediverse or Activity Pub.
I mean, there. Look, people, I mean, I don't want to scare people off. There are some black people on Twitter.
There are. There are some on the Fediverse. I mean, you just search that hashtag Black Mastodon, Black Twitter, and all of that. There's a ton in there.
Yeah.
You know, but again, if I go and explain that to say a cousin of mine or a friend
they
of
never
mine
heard
that
of
doesn't
Mastodon.
That doesn't That's live right. here in yeah. California.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. You're right, Dan.
Yeah. They're going to be like, "Why, dude?" You know.
Well, another discussion was that a lot of the affordances that people say Black Twitter needs, the discussion today was the journalists need. They want search. They want quote tweets.
Yeah.
They want to be able to search for URLs. That there's other things that, you know, Taylor Lorenz comes on to Mastodon and says, it ain't working for me, folks.
Boy, she didn't last long.
No, she didn't.
We chased her right out.
At least blunt.
Yeah. But she's also a broadcaster.
Yeah. Yep. She has different needs.
Yeah. I wish people wouldn't support Elon, but that's just me. So
I know. I don't like it either. But
I think it's a mistake. You know, same reason I'm not on Truth Social. I don't want to support it.
It's going to keep going down. I mean, his latest thing is that only people who pay will be promoted in the For You.
Yeah,
which means that's people I know and $8. And so it makes it completely unusable. He's one bit by bit.
Do you think people will pay $8?
I think I've seen one or two who have, but I think less. I think horribly of them now, and I will probably unfollow every single one of them. Seriously, if they have that kind of judgment. One matter to be on Twitter; it's another matter to give the schmuck money.
Let me ask about TikTok. You think TikTok will end up being banned, or do you think it will be? What do you think is going to happen? This is all going to go away. They've made their noise.
I think as long as we have lobbyists, it probably will go away because they want to keep the likes of Facebook and Twitter happy here in the good old U.S. of A. And figure out a way to trick those folks into trick the leadership into banning it so they can continue to get more mind share. I think that's more of a plan. That's just my two cents.
I'll give you a reason to hate TikTok. A Norwegian company, Nammo, which makes, I guess, ammo, interestingly, Norwegian ammo, says they cannot make enough Ukrainian ammunition because there's a nearby TikTok data center using up all the electricity. And Nammo says they can't expand ammunition manufacturing capacity to aid Ukraine until the TikTok data center... Either shuts
down.
Sounds
a little fishy, doesn't it?
Wow. It's monopoly. Well, I think you got to talk to the local utility. He's monopolizing electricity in the region.
Is there a lobbyist involved there?
Nammo is co-owned by the Norwegian government. You'd think they'd have some clout.
Yeah, you think they have a little clout here.
Yeah.
But that's Norway, right? It's very egalitarian, you know? We are concerned because we see our future growth is challenged by the storage of cat videos. This sounds like an Onion piece, but it's
really,
in The Guardian.
Yeah, it really does. I didn't read this one because it just sounded too wacky.
I don't know this reporter. It's got to be, I mean, it's weird. Actually, in Norway, of course, they call it tak-tak. That's nothing. Sorry.
Call what?
See yourself
out. I'm sorry.
Out, Mr.
What do they call tuk tuk?
See yourself out.
It's Norwegian, so it's tuk tuk. It's not TikTok.
Oh, tuk tuk.
Never mind.
Tuk tuk. Well, apparently the story originated in this Rupert Murdoch publication, Financial Times.
Oh, is this
that's not his. He doesn't know. He doesn't own the finished.
European ammunition maker says this is yeah.
This storage is aggregated. So who did the Financial Times get it from?
Let's see.
What's the telephone game?
Demand for ammunition has surged thanks to the war in Ukraine, which is using about 6,000 rounds per day.
I don't think you're allowed to do accents when war is involved.
Let's
go to Aftenposten.
Brandsig said demand for artillery rounds was more than 15 times higher than normal. The European ammunition industry needs to invest $2 billion in new factories just to keep up with the demand from Ukraine. let alone other European countries, according to the NAMO chief executive. TikTok is building three data centers. You know, if I have a choice between guns and cat video, I'm going to choose cat video. TikTok is building three data centers this year with the option of adding two more by 2025 in Hamar, which is 25 kilometers to the east of Raufoss. Norwegian data center provider Green Mountain said this month, asked whether it was coincidence that a Chinese-owned company, was stopping a defense company's expansion. Brandsegg replied, "I will not rule that out, that it's not by pure coincidence that this activity is close to a defense company. I can't rule that out." TikTok.
Okay, so I just found a story on Aftenposten.
Aftenposten.
Dated 3/27. So that's only one story in the major paper of Norway. I'll put it in the chat right now, and you can use Google Translate.
I'm satisfied that the Financial Times did not make this up.
No, but
it's weird.
I love it when Google can't translate the oddities of the language. So TikTok takes the power from the industry, says the headline. Subhead: the project at Hamar is an egg from hell. I'm sure that means something.
Talk for dog.
That's very Norwegian. An egg from hell. Yes. Next time I'm in Kristiansund, I will refer to it as an egg from hell.
It's in the text too. The project is an egg from hell. It could be a disaster for inland industries, weaken defense capabilities, and damage Norway's reputation in NATO. It's an opinion piece.
Yeah, maybe that's it.
All right, well, now I got to find out. Egg from hell. Norwegian.
The CEO of the company is the one being quoted, not government officials. So is it the CEO of spreading the story
of NAMO, as Norwegian a tool ammo.
In order to
yeah.
NAMO ammo.
You have a choice: cat videos or ammo. Actually, you know what? Because it didn't take, they're now saying and green steel. So now what do you, now how much would you pay? Gordon Moore, founder of Intel and the guy who was embarrassed that he was known as the creator of Moore's Law, passed away last week at the age of ripe old age of 94. Gordon was one of the, what do they call them? The unfaithful eight, the evil eight, They left Shockley.
Hateful Eight or something like
Hateful
that.
Hateful something. Now that's a.
That's a movie.
They left to start Fairchild Electronics. They left Shockley, to start in 1956, I think. This is a long time ago, in the earliest days of microprocessors. They left Shockley to create Fairchild, and then a few years later, the Traitorous Eight. That's the name of it. Gordon Moore, Sheldon Roberts, Eugene Kleiner, later of Kleiner Perkins, Robert Noyce, also one of the co-founders of Intel, Victor Greenwich, Julius Blank, John Herney, and Jay Last were the Traitorous Eight. They left Shockley in 1957 to found Fairchild. And of course, then later went on, three of them went on to found Intel. So he was one of the founders of Intel. And never called it, by the way, Moore's Law. It was the name Moore's Law was coined later by a tech journalist. Moore's Law also apparently was misrepresented. I've been saying for a long time that the number of transistors in an integrated circuit would double every 18 months. It turns out he said every 2 years. But what that means is processor performance would double every 2 years, and he has been pretty much correct ever since. The name Moore's
Law. Do
you
think it's going to end or not? It's still, he doesn't get to see how it turns out.
The name Carver Mead popularized the term Moore's Law in 1975. Moore often said he was embarrassed that it was called Moore's Law, but nevertheless, it was fairly accurate. I don't know if it's over. Is it over? It's too soon to say it's over. Here's the here's a graph from Wikipedia, Moore's Law. And, Over on the left-hand side, the Intel 4004, which had around 1,200 transistors in 1971. And on the right-hand side, more modern processors like the AMD EPYC and Apple's M2 processor. We're getting up to 50 billion transistors on a single die. So as you can see,
sizes, right?
Yeah, because this is a logarithmic scale. As you can see, it really has doubled every 2 years. It's actually been almost, it's kind of an amazing prediction. It's been so accurate.
I put in the rundown the original Intel business plan.
Oh, yeah?
Which is one badly typed page. it's amazing.
Was the third step profit?
Nailed it.
I think so. I think so. How about this? The Utah governor who signs a law requiring parents have to consent for minors to use social media. And by the way, minors is anybody under 18. You get, got, hey, 17-year-olds, you got to get mom and dad to allow you to use social media. And by the way, no matter who, you can't use it after 10:30 and you can't use it before 6:30. Based on the location.
They're going to be marching into homes, letting you have your guns, but making sure your kid's not online.
You could be working in a coal mine at age.
Well said, Mr. Jarvis.
Yeah.
Well said.
You could be making sneakers, but don't be on that Twitter.
Glenn's volume just went way down. Oh.
No, he's fine.
Oh.
Oh, he muted himself.
Good. Now you chased him away.
Oh, and he ran off. Wow.
Oh, no. Good Lord. Well, while Glenn,
I usually do that to Stacy.
Please, well, no, we're having some technical, my systems are.
I think you were fine.
No, he was talking. We couldn't, no.
Oh,
no,
we couldn't hear him?
Far, no.
Mic placement. My mic is doing weird things. So if you can hear me now, that's great.
We hear you now.
You can just edit me out of the show entirely. No one will miss me.
Nope, not happening.
By the way, this, like a ban of TikTok, would be almost impossible to enforce. I don't know what the plan is.
It's well, plus it means that every person in Utah, one, you got to find out whether they're in Utah. Number two, everybody has to prove their age.
Yeah. If you're my age, small government. I still have to go somewhere and say, see, I'm not 18.
The party of small government just wants someone in your house monitoring your age at all times.
That's all we need. That's all we need.
And no sex like that. However, being Utah, maybe you can have a few wives, but not doing certain things.
It's the party of small government and big binoculars.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, it's so awful. It's just so awful. You know, I'm sorry. I'm going to say it. Stacey's not here to get mad at me. But this is these are the fruits of moral panic. When you enable such panic about this, it allows crap like this to get passed, and it affects us all. Thank you, Ant.
Here from the Computer History Museum is the original poorly typed Intel business plan. The company will engage in research, development, ADN, manufacture, and sales of. They got typos in here. Integrated Electric. Should we feed this to ChatGPT and see if there's any future?
They need to clean that typewriter. New ribbon.
Look at the ribbon. That's what I was going to ask. Good What's God. Wrong with that ribbon?
I think they typed it at Marchin's website. This looks exactly like this is laggy scale Laga integration. Scale?
Laga? Look how it's higher too. They tried to correct something. It didn't work.
Yeah.
Why this principal? What is that? Principal customers. I guess that's what that's supposed to be.
Many of these customers will be located outside California.
Wow.
Wow. This is, I don't know, that's, I don't know who they.
It comes from the Computer History Museum, so that's why I believe it.
I guess they were going out trying to get investments.
How old was Moore?
94, which honestly, if you and I get there, we have no reason
watching
to
my
complain.
Father at 97, it's just, it's God
hard.
Bless him.
It's hard, He's 97. Wow.
97. And he's just gone through, with COVID, he went through two hospitalizations, internal bleeding, pneumonia, and hallucinations. And God bless him, he's back home and doing well.
Good. That's
outstanding.
Good.
Jeez, man.
1988 at the National Science Foundation. The new assistant director and a colleague swapped ideas about the future of a dial-up network, barely known at the time to the public, 1988. I kind of might have known about it. But anyway, restricted mostly to academia and federal agencies.
Show me the video.
Well, when was
actually,
the well?
Actually, you might have a video.
Yeah, I might. When was the well? Because that my first experience on the internet was on the well, and that was...
I was using the late 1980s.
Yeah, I think it was around then.
85. February 85.
Okay.
Help me get a job.
So the well, which was so a... Cool, it's still around. Yes, it's 1985. Was a early kind of chat board. A lot of people in the Bay Area especially were on it. Stuart Brand started it. Ran off a houseboat, his houseboat for a while. But I remember when I was on the well that you could issue a command and drop out of the forum into this weird thing where there were things like Gopher and Archie. And you could go around and see stuff. And I'll never forget experiencing that. And then, like, there's a lot of people on here. So I think by 1988, I'd had some experience with this internet. It wasn't what it was going to be, but I think by then I probably had. In any event, a doctor, William Wolf, this assistant director at the NSF, said, "It hit me like a ton of bricks. Imagine," the colleague said, "if this system was open to everyone." Within weeks, Dr. Wolf was in contact with the inventor of the internet, Al Gore, a Democratic senator for Tennessee. He'd been talking up for years before this, the promise of a data superhighway. You may not remember, but Al Gore's father was responsible for the interstate highway system many in the 50s. So as his son...
I like how he said, "You may not remember," to aunt who wasn't born for like a half a century later.
"You may remember, Doctor." What was Al Gore's father? He was Al Gore Jr., right? I think his father was Al Gore as well. Anyway, Dr. Wolf asked if Gore would spearhead efforts to drop the government gatekeepers from the digital domain. Now, I know you remember this because the NSF ran the internet for the longest time. Mm-hmm. And the NSF had rules, NSFNet had rules about commercial speech. You couldn't advertise on the internet. And the day the NSF gave the internet to the people was the day commercialism came to the internet.
What was that?
I wrote an article about that called "The Experiment is Over," right when that happened in 1994, maybe? Is that possible?
Let's see. 1998. What?
Well, no, 96 is when the browser came out. So it was
1995.
So this is from an article. I've got an article here from the NSF. They should know. The NSFNet went online in 1986, connected the supercomputer centers at 56,000 bits per second, 56K baud. that was how I was getting onto it, by the way. It was a 56, if I was lucky, a 56K
300 baud US for me robotics with
modem. Yeah, I had the acoustic modem before that. In a short time, the network became congested. By 1988, its links were upgraded to 1.45 megabits per second, which was what? The speed of a T1. That's right.
Yeah. Yep.
A variety of regional research and education networks, supported in part by the National Science Foundation and ARPANET, were connected to the NSFNet backbone, thus extending the internet's reach throughout the United States. Throughout its existence, NSFNet carried at no cost any U.S. research and education traffic that could reach it. If you can figure out how to get on this, it won't cost you.
Right. Yeah. It was April 21st, 1995 was the start of the transition. They agreed to support it for 4 years. But that's when the major commercial backbones, I have a list here, SprintLink, MCI, PSI, UUNet, Network 99. Do any of these names sound familiar besides maybe SprintLink?
I remember UUNet. Were the ones. So these were all the backbones, the internet backbones. Because up to that time, it was run by the NSF.
Contractors.
That's right.
Yeah.
The year 1998, according to the NSF, marked the end of NSF's direct role in the internet. That year, the network access points and routing arbiter functions were transferred to the commercial sector. I'm not sure
when. Well, that's not exactly right. Their own history is inaccurate because that process, I wrote this contemporaneously, and I know this because I started an internet company in 1994? 1995, I'm not sure I remember. And it was an early web hosting company, and we were able to do what we did because we could get a commercial link to the internet and run it legally.
Yeah. And I mean, it was I don't think you're wrong or they're wrong. It was a process.
Yeah. So it was a multi-year process, but they started it at a point
in 93. It said the proliferation of private suppliers led to an NSF solicitation in 93 that outlined a new internet architecture that largely remains in place today. So the transition began in 93, which would make sense.
I'm trying to remember when I was at Delphi.
It's freaking fascinating that you started. Oh,
it's
pretty
cool that he did that, isn't it? I didn't know, Glenn, you were a pioneer.
Internet company in 1994.
I had one of the earliest, was it 1990? And I'm trying to remember the year, of course, because I'm this old, I've forgotten. A company called Point of Presence Company. I started it in spring of 1993, and it was one of the very first web hosting companies. Because I saw a tiny screenshot of the NCSA browser that Mark Andreessen was one of the people developed at NCSA at the University of Illinois. Urbana-Champaign.
Well, we used to be Champaign-Urbana. Now they call it Urbana-Champaign. I don't know why.
But it was in Mac Week magazine. There was a tiny little picture of what the browser looked like, and I remember my boss at the time said that could be the future, and I was like, "You're right." And I started a company a few months later, but we were able to get T1 service that fall. That was commercial and hosted Peach Pit Press and a few.
Flash, April 1st, 1996. Glenn Fleischman, CEO of Point of Tidbits host site Presence Company, announced today that the company plans to expand its business to additional dimensions. Fleischman said that in 1996, the company's name will change to Line of Presence Company to reflect its focus on the second dimension. Oh, this is April Fool's.
April 1st, 1996. That's right. I used to host Tidbits way back. We hosted Tidbits on some old Sun microsystems.
That's very
But it was great. I mean, I wouldn't be where I am today if the NSFNet hadn't started the transition when it did, because it was exactly at the time when we wanted to put commercial internet on. And so I've often had the bragging rights. We actually made money. We didn't make a lot of money, like literally tens of thousands of dollars over the years. So we were profitable when I sold the company, and it remained profitable until it was shut down when the person who sold it joined what became part of All Recipes. And other people lost millions or hundreds of millions of dollars. I'm like, well, I made hundreds of millions of dollars more than they did by making $10,000 or whatever it was.
Popco. What a great name. Popco.com.
Popco.
You didn't keep the domain probably, huh?
No, it's into other people's hands now, but many years ago. Many
that's
years
a
ago.
Great domain name.
So, a popcorn company domain.
Popco. Yeah,
that's right.
Rich. So 1994.
You would have made more from the domain than from the company.
Yeah. By the way, that's still right. Glenn's phone number, I just want to say.
That's not mine. Sadly, no.
So 1994, you start that company. I didn't know anything about the internet until about September of 1995. That was the very first time my eyes saw the magical world of the internet. And then when I think about my kids and how they were just sort of born into it, and it was just like second nature. Yeah. It's so fascinating. You started a dadgum company. You were already deep in the trenches. And a year later, I'm just not figuring out, like, what the heck is this on this computer? Wait a minute. We have pictures on a computer that's from all over the world. How is this even possible? And I just remember my mind being blown. Back in 95.
We started.
You just remember the first time you had like a megabit per second connection and you're like, oh, the internet.
I remember getting T1 access. I think I got T1 access somewhere around 2000, something like that. And that blew my mind.
I think I didn't. That was about when I got ISDN, which is 128 kilobits.
Right.
And I didn't get anywhere faster than that for a long, long time. It wasn't until I got cable internet in the early days of. Before it was Comcast, it was At Home, and I had an At Home connection.
So I was at Delphi in the summer
Delphi.
Of 86.
Yeah. Genie, and, Delphi, and CompuServe.
Well, yeah, they're all of them, right? So I went to Delphi
86.
For 1 month.
Holy cow.
96.
Oh, 96, and, okay.
Or 94, sorry. When did the browser come out? Let's get this messed up.
93 or 94?
No, it was 94. It was the commercial browser. Came out in 94.
So
I was there in 94, and they were in the process of having to create a GUI. Murdoch had bought it. They didn't have a GUI because it was just a green screen monochrome monotype, right? And much panic about, we got to have a GUI, we got to be AOL. And I was in the office when they came in and said, this thing, the browser, is just getting released to the public. And all the geeks said, oh, hell. And the News Corp Hollywood people said, oh, that's too ugly. No one will ever use that. What are you going to get away from us?
They weren't far.
Let's keep making our
honestly, they weren't far wrong. It was really...
It was Illegally. October 1994. And I'll tell you, this is how early we were as a company. My business partner was quoted in the press release for Netscape Navigator 1.0 because there weren't any other web hosting companies out there. So they called us like, hey, you want to be in the press release? And Todd said, sure. And it cracks me up. You know, I mean, it all changed very quickly after that, obviously. But and we didn't ride that wave. Right. I joined Amazon in late 96 and sold my company and went on that bandwagon and left very quickly. But it was weird times. You could, like, you know, email Jerry Yang at Yahoo or something. And he'd be like, hey, what's going on?
You want to really feel old? There's now a plaque at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Mosaic, the first popular graphical browser for the World Wide Web, was created by Mark L. Andreessen and Eric J. Zbina at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications. Upon its 1993 release to the public, Mosaic gave Internet users easy access to multimedia sources of information. Web browsers have transformed the exchange of information. And now you know.
The sign will be updated in the future, back when we used primitive eye-based technology before our neural implants.
Yeah, it's pretty primitive.
Did you see that this is out of the rundown? Musk is now trying to do a part because his effort to do the implants got turned down because
Neuralink,
the little wires do horrible things. Yeah. So now he's trying to do a partnership with the company. He's told, the last person on earth I would trust to put anything in my brain is Elon Musk. And anybody who lets him do that is the extreme of the $8 schmuck.
Okay.
I'm not going to trust you with anything if you have that kind of judgment.
So back to Dr. Wolf.
Japanning goes back thousands of years.
That's right. They used to do it during the Napoleonic Wars on the sailing ships. They would cut
Neanderthals. Yeah.
Yeah.
There are Neanderthal skulls that show they were trepanning. I believe that's correct.
Wow, that's wild. Either that or somebody hit him with a round axe and it just happened. So William Wolf passed away at the age of 83, widely considered one of the creators of the Internet. He's the guy who called Al Gore, got Gore to push changes through Congress. He did not invent the Internet, but he certainly facilitated
Let's do recognize that Al Gore deserves credit for helping it happen.
He's part of the reason.
Yes.
Passed away in Charlottesville at the age of 83 on March 10th. He said, I don't know where I was headed when he helped create what we now know as the modern Internet.
So, it's a good obit.
Yeah. Very nice obit from the Washington Post.
Yeah.
Follow up on, remember Serial and Adnan Syed, was the subject of probably the most popular, first certainly podcast to have more than a million, listeners.
Serial.
Yeah. And of course it was the podcast that brought attention to this case, and eventually got the release last year of Adnan Syed. His conviction's been reinstated. Appellate court in Maryland ruled that a lower court had violated the right of the victim's brother to have been notified and to attend a hearing. So it's not like they're going to start all over, but they do need to
redo the hearing.
Yeah, just what a shame. I mean, what a shame. This is, I think, if you read what the lawyers for Adnan said was, you know, this doesn't help. What's her name? I'm sorry, I'm blanking out of the woman who was killed. Doesn't help the victim's family to have him go back to jail or this hearing again, because it's no one's any closer to actually identifying the person who killed him. It's killed her, because it's obviously, I mean, I followed this case.
So you believe did Serial imply that he was innocent or just raise the question? I didn't listen.
He raised the question. There's the one of his close family friends, Rabia Chowdhury, who was the lawyer who first brought the case to the attention of Sarah Koenig. She had her own podcast with John Cryer as a co-host, just by the way, of all things undisclosed. And they covered the case in depth. She wrote a book. There's a lot of information that wasn't presented, and the fellow, his so-called friend, had four or five totally different accounts of what happened. But the real issue is he was placed elsewhere. There was information from cell towers that wasn't disclosed to the defense. His attorney was dying. Adnan's attorney was dying at the time. She actually literally was dying and hadn't disclosed that. And mounted an improper defense, left things out. The prosecution didn't present all the information that should have been available. That's why it was vacated. It's very clear he wasn't in the place that he was said to. It's very unlikely that he had anything to do with it. And there's probably somebody else out there. I mean, there is somebody else out there who committed the crime, and it's just there's nothing that points to him being in the right place at the right time. And there are people who saw him elsewhere, and the cell records show that he wasn't there. So
right.
It's just so somebody got away with this.
So honestly, it's merely a technicality that her brother had not been given enough time. One day, in fact, noticed that they were going to have this hearing. He wanted more time. He wanted an opportunity to speak to his attorney to understand what the evidence was. And so at the last minute, he got on a Zoom call. The question was whether that was sufficient notice, and the court this week decided it was not. In a 2-1 decision, they reversed the earlier decision to vacate, temporarily reinstating Saeed's conviction. The court stayed the new decision for 60 days, meaning it doesn't take effect for 2 months, to give the prosecution and defense time to adjust to the reinstated verdict. He's not going back to prison. And I suspect the ultimate outcome will be the same, which is his conviction will be vacated.
Just highlights, I mean, the prosecutors joined in having this case vacated because they found essentially exculpatory evidence that was available at the time and wasn't presented. So it's a very clear thing. There'll be another hearing. The same information will be presented. It wasn't fully disclosed because I think it's being investigated, actually. And maybe it's her name is Haman Lee. I shouldn't, never forget the victim's name. Hopefully they will eventually bring somebody to justice for this because it's essentially an unsolved crime.
Yeah. Let's see. Did we talk about the Pope and the puffer coat?
No, we haven't. No.
I am ashamed to admit, and my regular duties every morning is to scan the news and find stories for, upcoming shows. And I saw the picture of the Pope in a puffer coat and didn't think twice about it, but I didn't think it was fake.
Really?
Well, I didn't think twice about it. I guess had I thought about it.
It was too good to be true. It was just too good.
I would have thought, well, it seems unlikely that the Pope would be wearing this jacket, this Balenciaga, especially since it's clearly tailored to be a papal regalia. It's got the belt and everything. Anyway.
The tiny, tiny hand with the tiny, tiny cup.
Yeah, it looks like he's got his own papal water bottle. Anyway, obviously it's fake if you think about it, but I just thought, oh, that's cool. The Pope's got a nice warm jacket. That's all I thought. Apparently a lot of other people believed it.
For not very long.
But not very long.
The truth was out. Yeah, the truth came out. All the, get ready, Ant, moral panic about the puffer coat is... It took no time for the truth to become out, and we all knew that it wasn't. And people were having a fit about this. And, oh my God, this changes all of our sense of truth. No, it doesn't.
Ryan Broderick tweeted, I think the Balenciaga Pope might be the first real mass level AI misinformation case.
Come
really?
On.
Really? No.
No.
No, I don't think so.
No. But the guy who made it, do I have that in here?
Oh, who made it?
He was the guy who made the picture. I was on mushrooms, man.
Oh, jeez.
Like puffer mushrooms.
Oh, we need to get that sound bite.
Ryan Broderick says that because he was taken in by it. He was scammed, so he feels.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
He got sucked in.
Well, it's
Chrissy Teigen was also taken in. I thought the Pope's puffer jacket was real and didn't give it a second thought. No way I am surviving the future of technology.
That's pretty good, though. That's
always something good. Salient to add to the
conversation. At a glance, like it did look real. At a glance.
Yeah. I didn't think.
It's
I mean,
cold
the thing
in
is,
Vatican City.
I didn't retweet it. I didn't share it. I didn't do anything with it. I just saw it in passing and didn't think twice. Thought, yeah, wow, that's cool. But, in hindsight, if you think about it.
It was too good to be true. But here's the interesting thing about this. Imagine if. You do that, you have it make that, and then you can go to a manufacturer and say, I like this, make this for me.
Well.
You can imagine
It could start generative a fashion AI trend.
Making fashions, exactly.
Yeah.
That's what's, that is, in fact, what's happening. Is yeah. They're using generative AI for places like Shein to make new fashion. That has an impact.
Do you realize you used the keyword for Midjourney, Mr. Jarvis?
What did you say?
Do you realize you used the keyword for Midjourney's AI? Imagine. That's how you start the
process. Yeah, that's how you start. Imagine. That's all you have to do. Here
the
is a
coming down from the ceiling.
Here is an, you won't get. An intrepid Amazon delivery. It's a police standoff, but there's your Amazon delivery guy going right in to make on. Sure.
I got work to do.
The package does
not paid enough.
You're neither rain enough. Nor snow nor sleet nor dark of night nor police activity will halt this Amazon
are the
delivery.
Cops yelling at him or something? No, he's just let him walk.
He's going up the driveway. there they go. They say, wait, what? Oh, they took the package.
Yeah, they took it.
Oh,
yeah.
He took it. He said, okay, we got it. Let's pass it along.
That's a legitimate the guy's delivery. Ammo in here. Yes.
All that driver knows is his job is done and he can report to his supervisor.
Oh, he took a quick picture of the package so that the guy knows it was delivered.
What did we do?
He's like, I did my part.
That's incredible.
I did my part.
And so calmly, just walking in, walking back.
I respect that. That man had a job to do, and he got it done.
He did it. That's
God bless him. God bless him.
Unbelievable.
He's kind of wondering now, hey, where are the cop cars?
Well, there's a lot of cars.
He's like, cop cars.
He's like, man, I got 300 more packages to get
out. Yeah, right, exactly.
He'd walk so far from his truck.
One down, $2.99 to go.
More than half a dozen Raleigh, North Carolina police cars are visible at the scene. The circumstances surrounding the standoff are unclear, but the video has amassed more than 7 million views.
Thanks for humoring me by going to that story.
That's how you get viral. That's how you go viral. All right. Have we done our duties covering the stories as we must? Have we done everything? I don't. The change log has.
There's no change log.
Nothing. Nothing.
No.
so little that I don't even want to bring the band in and get the drums and everything because they're on their smoke.
Because you don't want to pay them the money for it. Yeah, right. You got to pay them every time.
Well, I have to pay them. You know, union. There's a union fee for cancellation.
Of course.
Yeah. Because of course we use a union band. We don't. Yeah. We don't stint. I mean, but really, do you need to know that Google's going to start showing excessive heat warnings in search? I don't think you need to know that.
No.
We don't need to know, but it is a change.
It's nice to know.
I did put something in here for Jammer B.
I see that. I put something in here for you. Oh, yeah. But you put, okay, I got to tell you something.
It's, what?
Jeff's not going to like this because it comes from the
New
York
Post. Oh, I
know.
That's exactly why I put it in there.
Let me tell you something, man. So you're trying to send me to the hospital. I'm gonna tell you something right now. Most of the show, I've been in atrial fibrillation.
What?
I have been using my cardio.
Oh no!
Constantly.
Get the hell out of here.
Check. I think I'm knocking wood. I think I'm.
All right,
Jeff. If you keel over during a show, I'm not gonna forgive you.
Well, we've discussed that. What would happen if I did? We have discussed that in the past. So, Ann, you don't want to get Jeff upset tonight.
Oh,
you don't
want
to do that.
So,
dang it. Now I feel
bad. It's more about that snippet tax. We all know it's a terrible idea. Let me change the subject real quickly. Since we're talking Rupert Murdoch, you know he's getting married.
Yeah, to someone from Petaluma, right?
And she's a local.
Oh, no.
She went to Petaluma High.
She's from Petaluma.
Graduated in 1975 from Petaluma High.
1975? She's that old?
I love this. So Rupert Murdoch's what, 92, 93, right? She's, I think, in her 70s.
Jeez, I thought 66.
Oh, yeah, she's my age. She is. She's 66.
She's in her 60s, right?
Yeah. A good-looking woman. I love this, though, the optimism Rupert Murdoch showed by saying, I'm looking forward to spending the second half of our lives together.
Bad news for her.
He thinks he's going to live to 184? What the hell?
Did you see what the judge said about this, right, though, is that Rupert Murdoch's supposed to be testifying in the case that one of the Dominion lawsuits, right? He's supposed to do a deposition, and the judge, Judge Eric Davis, said he received a letter previously that said Murdoch couldn't travel to the trial in Delaware. And he's like, hey, so what's all this about him getting married and traveling between three houses and having no problems? And Fox lawyers are like, oh, we never said he couldn't. He was too feeble to travel. We just meant
get married. It's a honeymoon.
The judge said many different judge was very dubious. There's many different ways of saying dubious about the Fox lawyers.
Yeah. Wow. 66. She, by the way, is wealthy because her previous husband died at 3 years after she married him, and he left her a winery, a vineyard.
Sheer coincidence. It was nothing.
Yes.
I'm not implying anything.
Nothing at all. Thank you.
Nothing.
Thank you. He's my attorney, you know. There's the Petaluma article. Here we go. Rupert Murdoch's newest wife. Fifth time's the charm. Ann Leslie Smith of Petaluma. And by the way, courtesy of Ann Leslie Smith, her high school photo.
Aw.
1975. She's my age. And Fox is 92. But they're going to spend the second half of their life together. Her first husband was the son of the Huntington Railroad family, John P. Huntington. Then she married country singer Chester Smith, 27 years her senior, who passed away 3 years later.
It's just, are you saying, Rupert, likes, you got no shot?
She likes an older man.
What's the point? He's like silver fox, gray fox, is like a platinum fox, a rhodium fox, a uranium fox.
Rhodium fox.
I don't know. You have to go up in the metals. There's a Californium fox.
Ladies and gentlemen, Jeopardy champion Glenn Fleischman, everybody.
Yeah.
There's certain things you have to know. If you're going to do Jeopardy, you got to know rivers, you got to know lakes, and you got to know the periodic table of the elements.
Periodical table? Rutherfordium fox?
Before we get to our picks of the week and wrap this thing up, and before I get to leave for the next 3 weeks, let me flog the club twit. Now, some people are going to say, I can hear you now, Leo, I don't want to pay $7 a month to finance your fancy Dan vacations. Well, I will assure you that this vacation was paid for in 2019, long ago. Not one penny came from Club Twit. It wasn't even a twinkle in Lisa Laporte's eye. And every penny that we get from Club Twit goes into production, doesn't go into our pockets. But it is, I think, a very important and very valuable thing because we want to keep doing what we do. We love doing these shows. We love adding new shows. We have, thanks to the club members, added a bunch of new shows. This Week in Space was a club exclusive that is now public. We brought back Scott Wilkinson's amazing Home Theater Geeks, thanks to the club. Hands on Windows with Micah Sargent. Hands on Windows with Paul Thurrott. Micah does Hands on Mac, of course. We have the Untitled Linux Show with Jonathan Bennett. We have the Giz Fizz with Dick D. Bartolo, Stacy's Book Club, events that Aunt Pruitt, our community manager, puts together. Lots of great events and ad-free versions of all the shows. And all of that's just $7 a month. We want to make it a real value for your dollar because we really appreciate it. And I know $7 a month for some of you, that's just a couple of cups of coffee. And I certainly don't want you to do it if you can't afford it. But if you like what we do and you want to support it, you want to keep it going and want to see new shows launched, this is the best way for you to do it. And because you're giving us $7 a month, you don't have to hear any ads. You know, we don't have to monetize you any other way. So if you want to be the customer, not the product, twit.tv/clubtwit. We really appreciate it. And I promise you, not one penny will go to my fancy Dan vacation. Not one penny.
Not the one that they tried to cancel on you a gazillion times because you
did cancel
it yet.
Three times. I remember we were thinking, God, we've got this cruise in 4 months. They've just shut the world down for COVID. Do you think we should cancel the cruise? And we said, well, let's see. Maybe COVID will be over in a few weeks. I think they're saying that, right? And fortunately, they canceled it for us. And then again, we booked it for a year later. It'll be over by 2021. Surely it'll be over by 2020. No. Mm-mm. So I
want to tell you my greatest... Oh.
Sorry, go ahead. Well, I just said 2023. That's got to be safe, right? Well, we'll see. If I come back sick as a dog, I'm actually kind of nervous, to be honest with you. What were you going to say?
Oh, my greatest achievement is we had a family trip planned for June or July of 2020, and I booked it in January. We hit the button like right before COVID broke out right near us in Washington State, because we were sort of ground zero just north of us.
Yikes.
And I'll tell you, I got every penny back. I got the travel insurance refunded.
Oh, that is an accomplishment. That's a huge accomplishment. Yeah, I think we are out.
Well, where were you going to go, Glenn?
Paris and London. We're aiming for that in July of this year, finally, again. We're going to see if that goes.
You, too, are hoping that 2023 is the right move.
Well, I traveled last year, and I got COVID maybe in Vienna in November, but I was very, very mild. Didn't know till I got back.
This your trip with your son?
Oh, on that trip you got? Yeah, I didn't know that.
Oh, we didn't know you got COVID.
Got a very mild case, but I didn't test positive.
Did both of you get it?
No, somehow he'd gotten it last May, a mild case, and he didn't get it. And I also tested when I got home, was positive, isolated from my family, and they didn't get it. So
that's good.
I was the only one. I was a lucky chump, but it was okay.
Yeah, we got it on the last time we went on a cruise last summer.
Yeah, in Seattle, right?
Yeah.
You came up here and...
Yeah, no. It was fairly mild. It was like a bad cold. Lisa had longer term symptoms, unfortunately, but it wasn't.
What's she doing now? Is
she's fine. She's all better now. Just in time for this trip.
Okay. Good.
Yeah. But I think because I've had five shots now, has she. Plus,
I just saw Leanna Wen, who I disagree with often these days. She's in the Washington Post, but she's saying that us old folks should get another booster. The spring.
Well,
give me my shot.
She says it, but the CDC and WHO don't. So I'm going to defer to them instead of some writer in the Washington Post. Thanks for the input. I think all the evidence is we're still well protected from serious illness, not from getting it, but from serious illness, and that's really the most important thing. I think I'll wear a mask on the plane. I think I will. Certainly.
Well, I went to Toronto. I was the only person in the United Lounge wearing a mask.
I think in those public areas, because I will. Yeah.
RSV and flu are rampant, and there's a billion other things out there. So I'm like, I'm happy to not get RSV.
I don't mind a mask. Will I wear it in the Vatican? I think I'll be protected, won't I? Actually, we should mention, after talking about his big jacket, the Pope is in the hospital with a respiratory infection. So.
Yeah.
I hope he's okay.
Will you get to see Padre in Rome?
Yes.
That'll be so cool.
Very much looking forward to that.
Father, I know somebody who works here.
Yeah.
Are you going to get to see the observatory? I heard the Vatican Observatory is quite remarkable.
I will ask Father Robert. I don't know. Yeah, that's a good question.
It's supposed to be great.
He says he can get us into some places. He can do that. Ooh. So that's good. Let me make a note of that. Put that on my
This is an article in the New York Times about it. The Vatican Observatory has they've done some great exploration. They're well regarded. It's an interesting
piece of
science.
Isn't that hysterical?
In the middle of,
it's not what you would expect, is it? But he's a Jesuit. The Jesuits are very, the Jesuits believe in evolution. I mean, it's an interesting thing, you know, going on there. Anyway, pick of the week time, Mr. Glenn Fleischman. Do you have anything for us?
My pick of the week is Trader Joe's Everything But the Bagel Potato Chips.
God bless them. That's a good pick.
That is the best thing. Wow. I'm afraid they're going to have to. I want them to put a picture up of me at the store that says, do not sell to this man.
Where's Jennifer B with the ding?
It all started with the Everything But the Bagel seasoning,
which is good stuff.
It's a huge hit for them.
It's really good.
Yeah.
And then this, it's so, I just.
I mean, wish you hadn't told me
it's
that.
It's a drug. I'm really sorry. I had somebody on Shock, if you know Shock, on Mastodon. I was posting about it. And he said, I'm about to go. It's about 15 minutes from me. I'm about to drive it. And I said, remember to get a bag for the way home, too. He said, thanks.
Oh, God.
Thanks for telling me. I would have forgotten.
That's a bad sign. Holy moly.
It's delicious.
Okay.
I'm not a paid representative. I'm a sufferer. I'm a victim.
A victim of Everything But the Bagel.
So good. So
what is it? Everything But the Bagel if it has chips? I guess it is still Everything But the Bagel chips.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
Mr. Jarvis, do you have a snack pick?
No,
I think we should do snack picks of the week. now that we've gone down that road,
snack every week. No. That's
snack of the week.
No,
I have one. It's a spare rib.
Ooh, that's my snack.
I should make the Cardia mobile.
So seriously, tell me what's going on. Are you feeling symptoms?
I'm now fine, but I was.
Before the show or during the show?
Just as the show began, I said, "Uh-oh!" And then I ran off for a minute. I had to get a battery for this and take my pills early. And got it working. And this thing is, I mean, it's so amazing. Yeah.
That's from Cardia, K-A-R-D-I-A. And, of course, they're in the middle of a lawsuit with Apple who says you stole our idea. And it's going back and forth.
But this is a...
It works. Did you send the, you know, of course, it's not a full EKG, but it's something. And did you send it to your cardiologist for review?
No, because he's working at 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, you think? No, he's not.
Well, Cardia has cardiologists.
He endorses it.
Yeah.
He endorses it and thinks that it's working. So anyway, that's not it. I do want to mention that I've been waiting for Kevin to review the HP Dragonfly Pro Chromebook.
Those are beautiful.
They're beautiful, but then there was one report that the battery life was like 2.5 hours.
Oh, screw that.
No, Kevin, sane Kevin Topol came in and explained, no. If you did this and this and this and the screen is so bright, you're never going to want it on 100%.
Yeah, okay.
If you did that, yeah, but otherwise you're going to get 8 hours. It's okay. So it's very tempting. It sounds
like a $1,000.
Yeah, well, it's cheaper than the HP Dragonfly version, which was $1,200.
Yeah.
So that's better.
I don't know if you need a 12th gen i5 in a Chromebook, but...
I want the best, Leo. Yeah. I deserve the best.
Gosh, yeah, 16 really. Gigs of RAM.
I am the best.
Yeah, 256 gig storage. That's good stuff.
The best.
Yeah,
so much horsepower to be in a browser. Come on.
Yeah. remember the browser.
A lot of tabs, sir.
It's Chrome.
A lot of tabs.
It's the Chrome. Okay, so he says the battery life is pretty. He got 10 hours and 21 minutes, which is pretty good.
So yeah. I trust Kevin above anybody else. Yeah. So
it's not a big battery, great. Though.
No, it's not. I just want to plug. I was in Kitchener, Waterloo.
Yes.
On Saturday doing a debate.
Oh.
Guess what? On, you know, is social media ruining democracy? You can guess what side I was on. So there's a little clip there in my.
Should we play it?
There were very nice people on TVO, the kind of PBS of Ontario.
Here we go, ladies and gentlemen. It's only 58 minutes long, so enjoy.
No, it should be the one in there. I thought that was short. The one on Twitter is short.
Oh, okay. I clicked the
one I put in Twitter is just a little sound bite.
God, I clicked the wrong. No, if for some reason it's going to YouTube, that YouTube.
Me, it is?
Yeah, that's all right. Oh, let me copy the URL. It's a little, it's a thing.
Twitter's going to hell. We keep telling you.
Yeah, here we go. Here we go. I could see it's you because you're animated.
Well, yes, I banged the furniture, too.
We have met the enemy, and it is us. It is not technology. It is not machines. It is the ill in our own society that we carry into this medium from our past. It is the inequity and the hatred and the racism that we bring with us that matters. So to blame the technology is to stop us from dealing with these core issues in society.
Yeah. Right on, JJ. Right on, right on.
Get it. Tell it.
If I were a Twitter user, I'd retweet that.
So,
let me put it on Mastodon.
I was next to. I already have it on Mastodon. You can retweet.
Okay, I'll retweet you.
Yeah. You can boost me there. So that's Robbie Suave of Reason Magazine was my co.
I actually like Reason. I know it's a libertarian a little bit, but I really like Reason. Yeah.
I like Robbie a lot. I've liked him. He wrote a book called. His book out called. Tech panic. I mean,
Tech panic.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to like this guy when he writes a book called
Tech panic.
So, the deal of these debates is whoever changes enough minds in the audience wins. So when we started off, it was 76-24 against us, but in the end, it was only 60-40 against us. So we won the debate.
Oh, good. Even though you
nice
lost
Canadians.
But you moved more.
We won.
You moved
it's
the
just
needle.
Like Trump. We lost but won.
Now, I hope you get a recount. That is a great little clip, and I am retooting it right now. That's a really excellent clip.
But the really, really nice folks at TVO.
And what is your snack of the week?
I don't have one.
I've got
dried
one.
Prunes?
You can in honor of the missing Stacy.
Raisins?
Dalman's Stroopwafels.
Oh man, those are so daggum good.
You put it on your coffee cup to warm it up and melt the caramel, and it is good.
Get those on United Airlines.
Good. I'm gonna have some more of those at the studio, sir. Those are so good.
The thing you've got to watch out for with the Dutch, though, is they'll have you eat licorice, and that's a problem.
You can't eat licorice if you got high blood pressure. Don't do that.
But so salty, it'll kill you.
Yeah, Dutch. I like the Australian licorice. It's a little less salty. Finnish licorice is the worst, though. Finnish is like eating a pickle.
It's made of fish.
A licorice-flavored pickle. It's not good. Stroopwafel. Yeah, we used to have these in the studio, didn't we?
Yes.
I think we stopped because we were afraid it was going to kill people.
No, it won't.
All right, Sebastian, we need more Stroopwafels.
You have to be careful, very careful.
Thank you, Jeff Jarvis. And now it's time for Aunt Pruitt's Thing of the Week.
My pick, first one is very, very simple. And I just want you to go and put one of these at your desk. And they're inexpensive.
No.
Yes.
No.
A very, very simple dumbbell.
You
call me a dumbbell?
That is, which, 2 pounds?
That's 5 pounds.
Half a pound?
5 pounds. 10 pounds, 5 pounds, 10 pounds, either one. Just put one of those at
And then
your
what
desk,
do I do? People. I just leave it there to hold down papers and things.
You can leave it there papers.
And do you have one next to your desk now?
I have one next to me on the couch when I'm watching television, sir. I'm using them. So, yeah, just pick one up.
Whiskey in one hand, barbell in the other. Is that how it works?
That's it. And knock out 10 to 15 at a time.
What do you recommend? Are we doing skull crushers? Are we Arnold's?
Start with some simple bicep curls. Single arm bicep curls. Just do 10 of those.
Okay.
You know, when you're waiting on something to render on the screen.
I used to do that when I was sitting on my exercise ball, my yoga ball at doing Windows Weekly. I would do those. Lisa gave you hers. She didn't want them. We have them at home. We have a whole set at home. I'll keep it I will. What do you suggest for me, Ant? I'm a pretty strong fella. Maybe do they have a 1 pound version?
No, you better not go lower than 5 pounds, sir.
Okay.
Better not go lower than 5 pounds.
Now, you like these? They're coated, so they have a good grip. Is that
why? Nice. Neoprene?
Yeah. Well, actually, just any of them. I don't care which ones you get. My point is just folks don't necessarily have to go and spend $30 plus a month on a gym membership when they can do something simple like that at the leisure of their home, at their desk, or on the couch. I tried to tell people to do push-ups, and they whine and say, I can't do push-ups. Well, you can get a 10-pound dumbbell or a 5-pound dumbbell and just press it for shoulder presses or do some curls throughout the day. Get yourself a nice little burn and keep your heart rate going.
I'm watching Succession, I like to do the 35-pud kettlebell. Goblet squat.
Oh, wow.
Yes, that'll put some hair in your holders.
Stop.
I don't know what I'm talking about. Swing that between your legs and see how you feel. I think that's good advice. Man. The thing is, and Lisa's realized this recently, you don't have to do an hour a day. You can do 15 minutes 4 times a day. You could spread it out. You could do it when it's convenient.
Yeah.
Do a couple of sit-ups while you're watching, Furby and Phineas and Ferb, and just keep it moving. Keep it moving. Flexibility.
I know a lot of folks here aren't watching March Madness and into sports and stuff like that, but if you're watching whatever television show that you're watching.
Succession.
When the ad break comes up, do some type of movement.
We don't have ads on my TV.
Whether it's the standing squats, whether it's push-ups, just do something during that break time.
I will. I'm going to have a Stroopwafel.
While you move on to the next one.
That's what I'm going
to do. Or you have that as a reward.
At the end of the show, have a bag of everything but the bagel chips and a Stroopwafel. And then get the cardio, because you will
get the cardio,
be an AFib. Yeah. No, that's good advice. I think you're right. I think they just keeping moving is the thing.
Just keep moving.
Yeah.
Not hard.
Yeah.
Lastly, I want to give a shout out to Ms. Bonica Brown. She is a power lifter.
Holy
here in the
cow!
US. Young lady.
I saw
love
this
her.
Video.
She's got the best.
Oh
she's
my
got the
God.
Best dadgum Instagram ever. But she set the record in squats for
617
pounds.
No, come on.
And she
Holy
crushed
cow.
It. Absolutely crushed that record.
God.
But follow her on Instagram. She's a fun follow. Does a lot of little crazy stuff, but just she's also getting into showing, you know, her workouts and things like that. If you click to the left on that, she has her bench press from that as well as her deadlift. Her deadlift is just ridiculous too. If you click left.
I don't understand.
You usually had a little arrow.
There's no arrow on this. It's just one.
Oh, I'm sorry.
There's no left. What are you That's talking about? You're just messing with me, aren't you? you just come on, Leo. You know, just click left.
It's on my screen. I don't know what you did.
I don't know either.
Well, Instagram. Anyway, shout out to her. She absolutely crushed the nice. Powerlifting record there.
That's awesome.
Just last week, so give her a follow. She's good people too.
I could do that with a 1 pound dumbbell.
Do that. Do that about 1,000 times, sir. Yeah. And you may get to her warm-up set.
Yeah, really. Unbelievable. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us for this edition of This Week in Google. Glenn Fleischman, always great to see you. Glenn.fun. You implied that there might be pirated versions of your Jeopardy appearance somewhere.
Possible. It's possible.
Wouldn't be
possible
on YouTube, though, upsized probably, version. Right? It would be...
I don't know. Secrets. There used to be Daily Motion used to have a lot of old Jeopardy stuff, too.
Oh, but, I would love to watch you on Jeopardy. Maybe, you know, they do old shows. Maybe they'll just bring it back by chance. I'll be sitting there lifting my 1 pound weight, and there'll be my friend Glenn. Yeah. I like to actually, I do it when I'm rowing. I do it when I'm rowing. I do two Jeopardies in a row while I'm rowing because then I'm working my brain and my glutes. Which some people say are the same thing.
Can I do a random plug?
I was
going to
say, there's a joke in there, but I'm not going to
plug it. Plug away.
So on April, this is just a very Glenn thing. On April 22nd, if you're near Columbus, Ohio, I'll be part of an afternoon workshop at the Billy Ireland Cartoon Library and Museum at the Ohio State University.
Oh.
Talking about how comics were printed with actual materials from the Billy Ireland collection and my own collection, showing all the pieces that it requires to that would go from an artist board from originals through all the print production methods to going into a newspaper. So they're doing a whole afternoon. This is part of the exhibition Man Saves Comics about the great Bill Blackbeard, now deceased, who collected millions of comics pages and strips that were being discarded by libraries and other institutions. Sometimes the only copies, often the only copies of those comics across 100+ years of cartoons that survived because he was a pack rat. And they're all at the Billy Ireland now. 6 trailer truck full, 75 tons of comics were transferred to the library 25 years ago, and they're celebrating that with an exhibition. And I've got a video in there showing stuff, and I'll be there in person. So.
So what are you bringing? You're bringing some flongs and stuff? Or
they've got some flongs. I've got some flongs. It's going to be a good time. They've got original art, too, so they can show we'll show the whole stage, the whole process.
Oh, neat. Because it says it'll be a drop-in show and tell with print historian Glenn Fleischman. So you're going to bring some stuff from your collection and some stuff from there. So
I'll bring some, some flongs.
If you're in Columbus, actually, this would be worth a trip, if you ask me. Yeah. The Billy Ireland Cartoon Library and Museum. Yeah. Part of the Ohio State University.
If you're ever
driving
through Columbus, you should stop through. They do exhibitions. They constantly have exhibitions. They last for months at a time. And just an incredible, it's incredible that we have an institution like that that is actually publicly supported, in the sense that the Ohio State University is a public institution in that state to support comic arts. An incredible, very American thing. Other countries, the national governments think it's important enough. Like in France, there's Angoulême. Has an amazing center that I haven't been to, but everyone talks about, and we've got the Billy Ireland.
Very, very cool. Cartoons.osu.edu. Thank you, Glenn. Always love having you on the show. I appreciate it. I think we're seeing more of you while I'm gone, and I'm sorry I won't be here for that, but everybody else will be, I hope.
I'll be back.
Jeff Jarvis, you know him better as the director of the Townite Center of Entrepreneurial Journalism at the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism at the City University of New York. I hope you
have a great trip,
fine.
Boss.
I hope you're feeling better.
Come back.
Please come back. Oh, I will come back. Are you kidding? Wouldn't miss that for the world. And I'm putting in here right now the Vatican. What was it? Planetarium?
Observatory. I don't know how open it is to the public, but if you've got a Padre insider.
Maybe Padre can get me in there.
And Vatican knock on the door three times and say, Galileo was right, and they'll let you in.
The speakeasy?
Don't say Galileo is right. They'll burn you at the stake. What are you talking about?
Sorry, it's Oper si muove. It moved. It does move.
It does move.
That's what he said.
It does move.
I think is the Italian.
What do you got coming up on hands-on photography, Mr. Antprut?
Well, actually, I am doing a demo of this camera right here.
Is that the new Sony?
Nope.
Oh, Lumix.
This is the Lumix S5 Mark II, and I'm going to share my thoughts on that. And you are right. Sony did announce a new camera today, the ZV-EV1, which is a four-frame version of the previous ZV line. And I haven't taken too much of a thorough look at it just yet, but that was announced today, and maybe I get my hands on one and play with it. But that's what's coming up this week on the show is the Lumix S5 Mark II. And also, sir, since you're going to be gone, I'm going to be sitting in your chair on Ask the Tech Guys with Mr. Micah Sargent. So all of you Twig folks listening right now, feel free to send your video questions to us. Just shoot an email to askthetechguys@twit.tv, and maybe we'll give you a holler on Sunday.
That's awesome. Yeah, you're filling in for me and all over the place, and I appreciate you doing that. Thank you. Thank you, Ann.
My pleasure, sir.
We do This Week in Google every Wednesday around about 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern, 2100 UTC. You can watch us live at live.twit.tv. There's also an audio feed if you want to listen live. If you're watching or listening live, chat live at irc.twit.tv. Club members can, of course, chat in the Discord. If you're not a club member, twit.tv/clubtwit. Thank you, club members. After the fact, on-demand, ad-supported versions are at the website, twit.tv/twig. You can also, there's a YouTube channel you can find and watch. And it's a good way to share little clips if you want to do that. Best way to find all of our YouTube channels is go to the main channel, youtube.com/twit. You'll see links to all the other shows' channels there. And, of course, the easiest thing to do, the thing I would do right now before you forget, is find your favorite podcast player, Pocket Casts, Overcast, Google or Apple Casts, and subscribe to This Week in Google. That way you don't have to think about it. It just downloads automatically. You can listen to it whenever you're in the mood for silliness. Next week is Stacy. No, Stacy's not going to be back. Or is she? Mm-hmm. She is.
Nope. Next week is just like today, sans
me.
Mr. Laporte.
Okay. And Micah's going to host.
We're going to have Mr. Micah Sargent as the host.
Great. And then the following week, Jason, Jeff, Stacy, and Ant, so Jason Howell, will take over, in fact, for 2 weeks, and then I'll be back on the 26th. If you do want to follow my peregrinations, I am posting on a site called Polar Steps. If you go to polarsteps.com/laports, plural, Lisa and I have used Polar Steps in the past to kind of, it uses your phone's GPS to figure out where you are and takes pictures and puts it all together into a triptych or a travel map. It's open to the public. I know it's crazy. I probably shouldn't do it, but I will be post. I don't want to post on Instagram. And Lisa probably will post on Instagram, so follow her on Instagram. I'm not posting on Twitter. I probably won't even post on Mastodon or Pixel Fed. They'll just go here, and you can, if you want to follow along, you can see where we are at any given moment. Try not to jump us as we leave the hotel, though. I would appreciate that.
And what was that link again? So I'll make sure we have it in the show's notes here.
Polarsteps.com/Laports. You know what? I will put it in the... as my pick, not Stroopwafels. I will replace the Stroopwafels with Polar Steps. It's kind of a cool site, and then you can make a book afterwards and stuff. I'd be actually curious what you think of it. I'll make some books so you can see what the quality is. Follow Lisa and Leo as they travel. Have a wonderful couple of weeks, folks. I'll be back in a little less than a month. I will miss you all, but I will be rested and ready to go. And my brain, I'm hoping, will be a little more functional when I'm back. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time on This Week in Google. Bye-bye.
If you love all things Android, well, I've got a show for you to check out. It's called All About Android, and I'll give you three guesses what we talk about. We talk about Android, the latest news, hardware, apps. We answer feedback. It's me, Jason Howell, Ron Richards, Wintuit Dao, and a whole cast of awesome characters talking about the operating system that we love. You can find All About Android at twit.tv/AAA.